auditors. We don't need to be roughly equivalent to the size of a large power station that we've been in Kumbala. So that is the difference between customers and net contributors program. We've saved, if I can put it that way, loosely speaking, one power station. The amount of energy that's been saved is also equivalent, if one does the arithmetic, to 25 kilowatt hours, which is just over the amount of energy which would be produced by one of these large power stations in a year. So the entire consumption, and of course the underlying coal, which would have been otherwise consumed, has been saved as well as, of course, the CO2 emissions. So that's been a significant program for the country, and there's no doubt that load shedding would be a lot closer. We probably would be in load shedding, were it not for the program which we have in offline. Just in terms of the annual target, annually we need to implement projects which, roughly speaking, from a savings point of view, equate to the amount of electricity consumed by a medium to large city in South Africa, such as Buffalo City or Mango, or if you like, 2.5 salt plants. So that's every year we're taking off the consumption of one more of these cities. An annual target of 343, which is our target last year, to give an indication what it takes to implement that, just the various technologies that would be achieved either through, of course it's not just one, it's a combination of these, but to illustrate to members that the number of units we're looking at, 17 million of the downlights, that more than all the downlights in the country, from a heat pump point of view, about a million heat pumps installed residentially. We've got the numbers for solar water heating as well, broken up between high and low pressure solar water heaters. We'll come back to that in a while. But of course, it's not just about residential, and we're also looking at commercial and industrial projects as well. So at least a comprehensive project right across all the market segments, as Mike has explained. Within ESCOM, we have an approach which we call integrated demand management. We have various centers around the country which are located near our customers in order to assist them to implement projects. So we have about 100 members of staff which are spread across 10 centers. And the idea of these centers is to be a home to each advisor who would then go to customers and work together with them to identify projects and to implement those projects. We do, as I've indicated, have funding available, and there are rules associated with paying a portion of the cost of projects to our customers, and I'll show you the impact of those. But I think the important point from Edna's point of view is that it needs to be a strategy cannot be executed from a single point. It can be developed from a single point, but execution requires a national footprint, which we've come to understand. Mike illustrated and mentioned that it's important to benchmark yourself with the rest of the world, and this is an area which we've struggled with from Eskom's point of view. Our situation is reasonably unique. Other countries do follow certain approaches, either through agencies or even their utility program, tend to be focused more on the bottom line of that utility, which in many cases are privatized. In Eskom's case, our mandate is to keep the lights on. Our mandate is not to make money, and that's why energy efficiency core and central to our business. This is not in the business of selling oil electricity. We often ask, are you not contracted yet? Clearly not. Once again, our mandate is keeping the lights on for the economic growth and prosperity of our country. But we have looked at other parts of the world, and the conclusion that we come to is that our CFL rollout across the country, our door-to-door campaign, which has seen 54 million lamps being installed, is from what we can tell, the largest of its kind in the world. The World Bank, we have a significant loan, as members would know, with the World Bank, and the World Bank themselves have done analysis as part of their due diligence from ESCOM, and have given us a clean bill of health. They're very happy with our program, what they see looking at others around the world. We also kept benchmarking the cost of our program versus the cost of other programs, as you can see, and certainly we're amongst the lowest cost in terms of the dollar spent to get a megawatt saving. A powerless tool, which once again the members would have seen on television, has won numerous international awards for marketing and engineering. And then on an ongoing basis, with a number of institutions such as the EU's Energy Efficiency Watch Survey, we do our best to bring best practice on board. So it's not a static program. It's continually evolving. I'll mention some of the steps which we're taking in that regard. I'm not going to, in the interest of time, dwell on the slide which or the information which Mike had explained very articulately
really partly to say that once we must look at, from Esther's point of view, what the power constraints are. So, for example, I can tell you that during winter, of course, we all come home, we put on heaters, we cook more, we run lovely long hours that get darker earlier, so we put a light earlier, so we have a massive residential peak. The colder it gets, the more significant that peak is. For every degree colder it gets across the country, we're looking at about 700 to 800 megawatts of additional demand on the system. And that's why, from a winter point of view, it's absolutely critical that we focus on the peak usage within the residential sector. And similarly, all these sectors have particular objectives which we aim to achieve. The mining and industrial sector has responded extremely well to the time of these tariffs, which they have been, as a market, as a claim. And in fact, during peak time, use far less than they would during other times. So the peak are coming from residential usage. Chair, I'm going to skip over this slide in the interest of time and really just mention where we're going. We worked with
the... No, we're doing fine. Call back to the slide.
All right, excuse me, David. Okay, thank you. As mentioned, Chair, we need to refresh our program from time to time. And what we have done in the past, it worked extensively with the industry mining, in particular the mining industry, to implement projects. And within the industrial and mining base, 537 megawatts of demand have been reduced, second off the grid, implementing 164 projects through our demand side management fund. The cost of that has been just under R1 billion. And if one does the arithmetic, has come out to be extremely good value for the country. I've mentioned the CSR rollout that we've undertaken, and that's coming in at just over 2,000 megawatts has had a significant impact on country. And then, of course, solar water heating. We started out our solar water heating program in 2008, and I can report to the committee this morning that we are at current just under 300,000 solar water heaters have been installed through our program. So the numbers reflected on the slide are slightly out of date, which I apologize, but the latest number is just under 300,000 towards the government target of 1 million solar water heaters by 2014. So this program is on track. To provide more information on the project which is undertaken by with industry and mining in particular, the various projects, but basically deep level mines in South Africa need to be ventilated and they need to be cooled, and these require massive refrigeration systems and pumping systems, and this has been the technologies which we focused on most seriously with mines, and great progress has been made, as Mark has been explained. So really, from its side, I think we would wholeheartedly agree that the industry on the whole is energy efficient and aware of the need for energy efficiency. On the residential side, as has already been mentioned, we have undertaken analysis of the residential sector to make sure that our strategy for each of these is appropriate. Within the low-income areas, referred to as LSM 1, 2, 3, our focus at the moment is on solar water heating. This is on low-pressure solar water heaters and then on CFL exchanges. These are the immediate opportunities which we see within that particular sector to adopt energy efficiency, and it's gone very well. Big uptake and strong demand for both the CFL program as well as the solar water heating program. In the middle income area, which we refer to as living standard measure 4 to 7, here you can see the appliances, a broad range of appliances, and a different strategy is required. It's the door-to-door approach, the naturalized approach to low-income areas is not appropriate. What we have at the moment is a program which refers to the residential mass rollout, and so far since January we visited just over 700,000 homes in South Africa and provided a pre-exchange of lighting, but we've also looked at down lighters, a pre-exchange of down lighters. We've also installed free timers and geysers and free timers and swim pool pumps, as well as installation of free installation of an energy efficient shower head. So once again, the economics of this turn out to be very good. The benefits in relation to cost is excellent. What we are currently building, Chair, is developing our strategy for the high income areas, and this is where there would be once again a different approach needed. And we're looking at the moment at a retail model whereby we would be encouraging homeowners rather to make energy efficient choices at their point of purchase many high-income areas, homes simply don't want Eskom or any other contractor through their door. They would prefer to do it themselves. And this is why we totally agree with Mike. We need a very different strategy in each of the market segments. So once again, this is a mass rollout door-to-door approach in low-income areas works extremely well. The middle-income areas are residential mass rollout, where residential mass rollout, where we would still be looking at contractors making an appointment with the home, going to visit the home, and in the high-income areas, we have to find a way of getting over high walls, dogs, and all the alarms and all the rest of it that's characterizing that side of the market. Sheriff mentioned the solar water heating is just under 300,000. We are at more than 285,000 at the moment. The government, cabinet has approved 4.7 billion rand for the rollout of the balance of the solar water heating on the first 300,000. We are in final discussions with the Department of Energy as to if I can put the rules of the game for that, and we're very excited about taking this project forward together with government, together with local municipalities, and of course suppliers and homeowners. Chairman, I'd like to address the residential mass rollout, other than to say that our intention for the next 12 months before the coming winter would be to spend 5 billion rand on this program to save 1,000 people. So this is our target. We really want to take forward the success of our pilot phase of the first 700,000 homes, and we would hope that all South Africans, particularly in the middle to upper area, would have an opportunity to upgrade their homes as part of this program. So the pilot is a central part of our campaign, as mentioned. We audit the results from our pilot system as well. So every time that a message comes out from television, our audit actually can measure the reduction from the national grid perspective. So those results are actually analyzed on a daily basis, and we get reports on a regular basis. What we see is that, of course, if we fly to green message, which says everything's okay, we get a minimal amount of savings, as we expect, then to orange, then to red. We can actually see how much more savings come about as a result of the more severe messages. It's quite sharp too, so it goes like that every time a message comes up. So we see it, and we understand that it's the youth and the young learners in particular who go around switching for clients and depending on how the systems get tightened. It really has made a material difference to our country. Particularly during 2010, during the World Cup, there, of course, there was a big concern about the given that they went up with the light sale, and Farage, I think, at its peak was over 600 megawatts of measured demand. So the country really came together to make sure that the light sale would be a very great performance from the side. I've mentioned skills development and localization. This is a big drive. Every single proposal that comes to Eskom, every single tender that we have, has a significant interrogation to make sure that we get the very best out of the opportunity of energy efficiency for economic growth as well. In terms of solar water heating, illustrated here, for example, we're working together with the Department of Trade and Industry and the Department of Economic Development and the Department of Energy to make sure that we develop capability for the manufacture as well of solar water heaters. We recently audited 44 factories in solar water heaters in the country, so we're seeing a proliferation of factories. Not all factories are producing 100%. In fact, none of the factories are 100% local. There always are certain components which are imported, but to the maximum extent possible, we'll make sure that our programs take local systems and give preference to black women-owned companies to install and maintain those systems. We also are actively involved in working together with communities in a broader sense within Southern Africa. We're part of what's called the Southern African Power Pool, which consists of the SADC countries, of course, not Mauritius, they're not electricity supplied to us, and Madagascar, but within the Southern African Power Pool, we have exchange programs to share information between ourselves on energy efficiency, so we're well integrated with other utilities in Southern Africa. We are actively involved in developing young scientists because I think right across the Eskom business, of course, it's important that we get engineers coming through, which and that means developing a passion for electricity, energy, and science, and we're actively involved there. We, from an energy efficiency point of view, have a very comprehensive schools program. There are approximately 700 science teachers, which we get together on a regular basis and it's about teaching the teachers, because we believe that if we work together with the teachers, we provide them with material, posters, etc., etc. So when they are back into the classroom, they can make sure that the learners in the classroom understand the importance of energy efficiency and how to be energy efficient. So we have competitions and you know, even from very young colouring competitions for the young to more science projects for all that learners. It's very important from our point of view. Student training at our campus in Midrand, we take tranches of school of matriculants, and we develop we work together with them. We train them in measurement verification, and so we have the first cohort. In fact, the second course cohort is now finished the training. So we're looking at a group of about 30 students that we consistently every 2 months are developing internally with NESCOM, with the idea of deploying those students in the industry. So it's one of the great times where we're excited when the EIEG or its members seals our staff. That's our whole intention, to develop them so that they can fulfill a role within electricity infrastructure of our customers. I've gone through that. Perhaps to mention, just in terms of, I mentioned that we need to constantly refresh our program, and while we've had focus in the past, again, on industry and mining, our focus now is, in addition to industry and mining, to look at the commercial sector. This is where we developed very quick-to-implement programs, which refer to our standard offer and standard product funding mechanism, which are both going very well. So it's very easy now for a commercial enterprise or a building, a hotel, shopping centre, shopping mall, hospital, buildings such as a parliament, to make use of the funding. And you can see that just on the picture on the right, how fast the uptake has been.
You said parliament?
Yes, sir.
So we can get a few passes, right?
Yes, of course. Oh,
yes. Couple of failures, listening.
I think the job there, Sure. I think the chair of the audit committee is also a member of our executive committee. I think we'll manage any conflicts with the chair.
Members, I know it may not come through very clearly. Myself and Honorable Hailing were in the Climate Change Steering Committee, and one of the things we're driving is for greening of Parliament. So that's fine. Though it's a light note, but it's also serious that if there's a way of failing of expediting our green of Parliament can be, here is an option. Sorry for the interruption.
Thank you, Chair. I can report that we have been involved in the greening a number of our government buildings as well, prisons, schools, etc. So it would be a pleasure to work together with the committee on the Parliament building. At the moment, just to report that we are at the moment implementing project upgrades at the rate of about 1,000 commercial buildings per month. That is the rate. So it is really going extremely well within the commercial sector at the moment. 1,000 sounds like a lot. Unfortunately, from a grid perspective, 1,000 doesn't amount to 1,000 megawatts. You know, it's a far less savings per project. This can be a local spa, it can be your Kentucky Fried Chicken, it can be but 1,000 a month we are doing. So we've seen this going extremely well. Of course, we're still busy with residential, we're still busy with large industry, but we now have a program which is available to everyone in the country, big and small. I've mentioned, Chair, the energy services company and the need to develop ESCO. So what we really have been doing is making sure that particular black and the black woman-owned SME ESCO have an opportunity on our program. And what you can see in the spike in the year 2012-2013 is the number of ESCOs who have submitted projects through us for projects executed in the current year. You can see a significant increase at about 350 ESCOs. Already some of the ESCOs have registered projects for the next two financial years, and you can see those bars in the 2013 and 2014, and then in the 2014-2015. So we will continue our strong focus on developing the ESCOs. From our own point of view, of course, we can't ask the whole country to be energy efficient and not be energy efficient ourselves, so it's just provide feedback that ESCOM, of course, ourselves have a number of buildings. We've completed retrofits, energy efficient retrofits at 111 of those buildings. And in terms of the commitment of the energy efficiency accord to save 15% of our internal energy consumption by 2015, we believe that has already been achieved. Of course, we won't stop there, but certainly to give members the assurance that we take this very seriously. Further to energy efficiency, we've also begun installing photovoltaic systems, and you can see on the bottom right of the slide is at our car park in Edward Park. That car park has now been covered, and on top of the covers are photovoltaic panels. In fact, we're generating a significant portion of the electricity needs of Edward Park through photovoltaic systems as well, and we would be looking to work together with customers again on such systems where the systems are reducing the consumption of the customer's building. In conclusion, Chair, energy efficiency is absolutely essential for security of supply in the country. There's no doubt about it. There certainly needs to optimize and to prioritize, as Mike has indicated, but that has served the country well so far. It's important that while we develop new strategies, that we make sure that there's continuity of the program. We simply don't have the luxury to stop this program for a couple of years while we go through a replan. We need to change on the move if change is required. In terms of the way forward, we've applied as part of the NYPD application. We've applied the next 6 years for funding to achieve a further 2,557 megawatts. This, once again, has been based on the back base, which Mike and me have explained. And we'll, of course, see in the coming months as to how that pans out, so that is simply a view of this application and view into the future.
What are the previous targets which you have achieved?
It was 1,000 megawatts over 3 years. So this would be 2,500 megawatts over 5 years. Instead of 6 years, including the next. So it's roughly the same rate as we've been going in the past. Of course, what happens here is that on the one hand, your low-hanging fruit disappears, but on the other hand, new technology comes in place. So on balance, we would say that we will be looking to continue at the same rate. As has been done. Once again, 2,500 megawatts is roughly equivalent to the output of a large coal-fired power station, so we'd be wanting to take another coal-fired power station off the grid. Chairman, thank you. This is a painting which was done by artists, which he looked at removing 100,000 light bulbs. You can actually, if you count, it's like 100,000 light bulbs. Maybe a pretty one.
Thanks. Come again.
Thank you, Lai, but I put this for a light-hearted moment, no pun intended. This is actually an artist decided to draw 100,000 light bulbs and make a piece of work out of it. So if you actually count them, it's just a slide showing 100,000 light bulbs.
Meneer Eppinger, who counted? Please, who counted? I'm not going to ask one of the members how they were counted. Just who counted? I'd like to invite that person over a cup of tea.
Chair, I'm well taken. This has certainly not been through our mission investigation.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Ray. The FIR.
Thank you for the opportunity of addressing your committee on this issue. I'm CSR from the Built Environment Unit. My name is Lewin Beck. I'm a principal researcher there. Dear Chair, I think this morning what I would like to do is to take a slightly larger view of the problem. We are the unit at the CSR in the field for the built environment, not just buildings. So I'm going to step there. If you imagine the helicopter, I'm going to go up a little bit so we look at a slightly bigger picture. And let me also take the opportunity of complimenting Eskom on the presentation and the work that they are doing. Perhaps I'd like to start here just looking at the World Energy Outlook Report of 2010. Let me understand the global scenario. We're looking at an expected demand in energy to increase by 36% to 2035. That is a relatively modest annual increase of 1.2%. Obviously, as the global economy comes back on stream, that number could change. Two-thirds of that growth is going to occur in non-OECD countries, and 30% contribution to that number by China. So clearly massive relocation of energy consumption. But this is the one that I think would be of interest to the committee chair. World demand for electricity expected to grow, most rapid growth in billions. It's for this reason also that the IPCC report fingered built environment and buildings as the low-hanging fruit. We know we are in an urbanized world. We are in an urbanizing world. We know we are looking at megacities, the cities of the future, the cities of having a population of between 15 to 20 million. And clearly they all are accommodated in buildings. They work in buildings. They play in buildings. They worship in buildings. So we can see that that sector is going to grow at a larger rate than what you would normally find across the board. Non-residential showing the most rapid growth due to growth in service activities, especially in non-OECD countries, as we see increased demand for office space, for hospitals, for hotels, and other institutions and organizations. And again, Chair, if you just look at South Africa's own scenario, the extent to which we need to roll out social infrastructure in South Africa, we can anticipate that those are going to be energy and contribute to energy and electricity demand going forward. And then here's the rub. The consequence of this is that fossil fuels account for one half of the increases of oil dominance. So to the extent that we urbanize, to the extent that we need to build to house people, we also make use of fossil fuels, and we contribute obviously to greenhouse gas emissions. Looking more specifically at the South African building stock scenario, at 2005 figures, the last figures done by a colleague of mine at CSR, we anticipated our calculation showed about 11 million dwelling units with a value of about 809 billion in 2004. Non-residential with a value of about 129.4 billion, but that's 70.6 million square meters of non-residential space. In 2007, we added an additional 13,000 square meters of residential for 4 million square meters of non-residential and 6.5 million square meters of alterations and additions. Now, 2007 coincided with an uptake in the construction industry. There's been a slowdown since then, but it is cyclical. So that again, when we get out of the slight slump we are in, we will be back in these kinds of growth. We then just look at the energy in the built environment. The global figure is around about 40%. About 40% of all the energy generated in the world is used to run the built environment. So it's a major consumer of energy, not just the electricity, of energy. In South Africa, that figure is slightly low, and I'll come to that. If we start unpacking where that is going, you can see the graphs, the industry relatively stable, transportation still increasing, and buildings still increasing and increasing at a higher rate than the other sectors. Again, a reason to examine very carefully the way we construct, design, construct, and operate the built environment. And if you unpack that a little bit further, you will see their buildings are 48%, industry 25%, and transportation 27%. These figures will vary across the world. So these are kind of global averages, and I think FOM has some numbers which are more specific and pertinent to South Africa. And then you can look at the building sector itself, residential and commercial, as major components. And that's basically where the energy is going. Cooling, lighting, office equipment. Let me just speak with the cooling and the lighting. You would have seen from Eskom's presentation their focus on lighting, and you can see why. That's a major component of that pie. Cooling clearly becomes problematic. It's air conditioning systems. It is something that needs to be examined at a more detailed level to get more efficient units in place, specifically with an eye on the anticipated temperature increase in South Africa, which we're anticipating to be about 4 degrees in the interior, about 3 degrees along the coastal region. And the consequence of that will just be a greater demand for cooling of buildings, which will make that pie chart just more distorted. So clearly a major intervention needed in the HVAC industry. To ensure that we achieve the same kind of efficiency that we are seeing currently in the lighting. Office equipment, major component, this is something that's not on the radar screen generally because people go and buy the units wherever they can at whatever price they can. And I will speak a little bit to that, but essentially the push here needs to become energy rated with a major drive to begin to drive that figure down. You can actually see that office equipment usage is higher, and we are talking here in offices, but the office equipment energy consumption is higher than lighting and equivalent to HVAC. It's a major opportunity for saving. And then it starts paying down as you go around the winter heating, cooking, space heating, ventilation, refrigeration. The problem is a slightly bigger problem than simply saying, well, we have a building, how do we make efficient? And I want to start here, material extraction and manufacturing as confrontation spoke to the extent to which they're engaging around processing and industrial activity. We sit with a challenge in the building industry, Chair. The base materials that we use to build, steel, aluminium, cement, clay, are some of the most plentiful materials in the world. It's the very stuff at the core of the earth is made of. That's not the challenge. The challenge is to turn that base material into a material that you actually build with. It requires temperatures anywhere between 1,500 degrees to 3,000 degrees. And all of that is either coal-based energy, oil-based energy, or gas-based energy. It is incredibly dependent on fossil fuels. So just the process of actually making the material from which we construct this built environment is requiring these kinds of temperatures to convert the raw material into a finished product that goes on top of it. So we have to actually start very early in the life cycle to understand the total energy consumption. And then, of course, you get into your transportation. I got here this morning on an aircraft, and I had a car to get here. And I will repeat that process to get back to Pretoria. All of that it requires energy. The water that we use in Gauteng, likely to become a mega city by 2030, 2035. That water comes from the Lesotho Highlands Water Project. The water only gets to Pretoria and to Johannesburg because it's up. So the way that we locate our cities, and the way that we design our cities, conceptualize our cities, requires a backup system that is completely energy dependent. So we have a supply point in Lesotho, and we have a demand point in Gauteng. And the only way to meet that is by installing energy-intensive pumps the whole way. Once we use that water chair, and the water that comes out of your tap doesn't come out of the tap because it feels like getting out. It comes out because it squirted out of the pump. And once that runs into the drain, it doesn't just run away because there's a nice look, but it gets away because it's pumped away. And it's pumped to a place called a wastewater treatment plant. And that wastewater treatment plant uses pumps to treat the water. And then whatever we're left with, we go and take to a landfill site, which generates its own energy demand in terms of management. So the entire cycle, from taking, extracting the raw materials, converting the raw materials into construction products, building the building, operating the building, accessing the building, going back home, doing all the business that is associated with it, and at the end of the day, the wastewater and sewage and all the other stuff that is associated with it, and then you demolish it and you dump it, that entire cycle is energy intensive. And it's fossil fuel intensive, as you said. So I think it's also useful to note this. When we speak of savings, we speak of savings at the end of the pipeline. So when I reduce the energy consumption of a building by 50%, it's at the end there. But look at the losses from the 100 units, which is the potential input of the coal or the oil when you actually deliver it to the plant, to the time when it actually gets to the unit is down to 9.5 units. So the saving is not just the saving of at the house. It's the saving along the entire transmission process back into the production facility. Now, Chair, I want to talk very quickly about some solutions that we need to look at a built environment level rather than just at the building level. The first thing we need to understand is containing urban sprawl. To the extent that we allow this scenario to happen, it simply means that the sewage pumps, the water pumps, the stormwater pumps, the transportation systems, the electrification systems have just to go that much further and to work that much harder to support. So densification in reducing the extent of services required, the extent of pumping required, is only going to happen when we stop this incredible spread called urban sprawl with all of its energy demands attached to it. The second thing is then to compact those cities. And what's interesting about this particular slide, the illustration on the right-hand side is the book that the town planner in Phoenix, the bottom right-hand slide, are doing. Phoenix is one of the cities in the United States which is basically a desert city. But they're also anticipating an increase, simply increase of around 3 to 4 degrees, on top of a very high temperature already. And essentially what Phoenix is saying is, how do we become a desert city? And they are looking, for example, at some of the desert cities in Saudi Arabia and in the Middle East to understand how you build a city to accommodate climate. And as Phoenix is saying, how do we transit from an American grid city to a Middle East, North Africa desert city? Because that's where we're going to achieve, ultimately, the kinds of savings in energy that we need to if we're going to go forward and manage a whole bunch of other things associated with climate change and so on and so forth. The third one is to extend our public transport. Chair, I'm sad to say this, but despite the wonderful success, and it is a wonderful success, of Caltrain, there's a missed opportunity. Not having, and this is one of the stations in the Caltrain, and what you can see is a freeway system. You can see the Caltrain system, and you can see massive parking. And that parking should not have been parking. That parking should have been a little city. So that your transportation requirements is called transit-orientated development. You use the public transport system because it's a lot more energy efficient than you driving your car to work and parking that here the whole day and coming back this evening, getting in your car, and driving all the way back to your house. So moving people towards major transport nodes becomes a significant component of achieving energy efficiency. It does mean we need to change our understanding of what a city is and what cities work. We cannot continue supporting it on the basis that we are supporting. And that's linking in with all of these, the full modal transport modes, whether it's aircraft, and we know we're talking about aircraft, airports, cities, aeroports in South Africa, but it's the full range of transportation to get people out of their cars into public transport and to reduce those things. So once you've done that, you can then actually start integrating your urban development. Now, the top left-hand illustration is a classic transport-orientated development where you have bicycles, you have motor cars, you have taxis, you have buses, you have trains, all supporting an integrated development. The bottom left-hand one is the more interesting one. It's a mixed development. It's in the United States, and it consists of three buildings. The left one is an office building, the center one there is a residential building, and the one on the right is a hotel building. Now, you know that the one on the left, Monday to Friday, between 8 to 5, is going to be operating at maximum efficiency. And the one in the center is going to be idling because it's a residential building and all the people at work. In this scenario, that building, you can see the wind generators on the roof. It's got photovoltaic panels, water recycling, all the rest of it. Those wind turbines are working. The solar panels are working. The water recycling process is working, but it's not being used because the people are not in the building. They're in the office. So it sends those services to the office. On the weekend, the office building is not working. The residential building is working 100%. So the office building sends its services to the residential building. And you start sharing your load. You start managing these loads across the city between building types and when they're active and when they're not active. Nighttime, daytime, weekend, non-weekend. And then you put that all together in an illustration on the right-hand side that says, how do we begin to put transport-orientated development together? How do we begin to integrate that across services where you start sharing the services? And how do we do it in a way that provides a kind of open space, that high-density city? It's a completely reconceptualization of how we view a city. It starts at the city level. Before you can actually get into the building level, you've got to get this right. Because this is where the major energy thing goes. So once you've done that, you can then start looking at the building. The CSR has developed an alternative house to the RDP house. We will be doing a presentation later this morning to Human Settlement Department, where we have cut the energy requirements on an RDP house by 50%. Simply by looking at the building envelope, increasing the efficiency of that building envelope. It has nothing to do with the lights. It has nothing to do with the solar water heaters or ground pumps. It's got to do with how efficient is that building envelope at cutting down the temperatures between very low and very high so that you flatten it. Because the extent you flatten the chair, to the same extent you have to put in less heat to warm it when it's cold and less cool to cool it when it's hot. You simply flatten that out completely. And this is a German example. We've constructed our house on our site, which we think is going to be probably the benchmark for South Africa. And we're busy measuring it at the moment, Chair. Data loggers in it, and we're recording temperatures inside and outside in a 15-minute cycle for a full year to get an understanding of what energy efficiency becomes when you start addressing it actually at the technology level of the building. Number six is a concept which I am particularly favorable on. Actually, small-scale solutions. This is a wonderful concept that is, to what extent can we get buildings off-grid? Not just off energy grid, but off water grid, off sewage grid, off stormwater grid. I'm into some pains in the beginning, Chair, to illustrate the extent of services that are required to run a city. And all of those services require energy. When you start going off-grid, we are currently at the CSR designing a building to be erected in Port Elizabeth, which is a net zero building. It will not be connected to the grid for energy. It will not be connected to the grid for water. It will not send sewage into the sewage line. It will not send rainwater into the stormwater line. Because that way, you free up the challenge of how you make cities run when a building actually can run itself. And here we go. Net zero services building number eight. The building recycles its own water, generates the energy it requires. I like a concept that's beginning to emerge, Chair, of not just net zero because that's a neutral position, but a green plus. So you actually generate more power than you need and you put it into the grid. You harvest more water than you need and you put the water into the grid. You do not put sewage into the grid, you actually put it into recycle. This is work that is currently occurring in a number of parts of the country, and we're trying to develop a South African model for this, as I say, in South Africa. We're hoping to start construction on that in March next year. Chair, once you've done that, you've then actually got to go and look at construction materials. Can we transform the construction industry away from these energy-intensive materials into a new generation of materials that require less energy to make? We have a major project running at the CSR Chair looking at fiber composite materials that's using natural fibers in a natural resin combination. It requires much lower temperatures. It's a completely renewable resource because you actually harvest the fibers and you can put it back and recycle it when you're finished with the building. And ultimately, my work at the CSR Chair in this illustration, can we make every one of these pieces of this building of a biocomposite in a plug-and-play method? So when you want to change it, you can clip it and you put a new piece back. And all of that will be an energy efficiency methodology. Number nine, Chair, is design of construction waste. This, unfortunately, is a provincial government project, no name, no backdrop, that I was asked to go and advise on. This was one of three heaps of material that had been wasted on this construction site. Now, that costs government four times. It costs you in getting the material to the site. It costs you in cutting that material. It costs you in taking the waste material to a landfill site, and it costs you in managing the landfill site. Four cost factors because of the waste.
What about law enforcement when they come?
Absolutely.
As you know, one member, you usually see it so nicely if you're flying low, we're about to land in some of the areas. You see along a dead road, you know, you see how the construction company is just dumped. Sort of an out of way, out of sight here arrangement. No, I'm just provoking that. Do you take that into account? Because there has to be law enforcement for that because of the negative environmental impact.
No, that's absolutely right, Chair. There are fairly stringent regulations in place, but policing that becomes a challenge, as you would know. It's the easiest thing in the middle of the night to take a bucketload of that and go dump it. You see it tomorrow, but you have no idea where it came from.
I like the middle of the night.
Chair, I think. And I think this is an important slide. When you've got issues number 1 to 9 addressed, then you can start looking at number 10. Why do I say that? You have to drive down the demand for energy before you can get to a point where your renewable energy can match it. You cannot continue running your building in the same old way and hope to think that you can run it off a renewable source. Because the best will in the world, the technology just is not going to get you to do that at this point in time. Yes, you can run your lights, you can run a couple of computers and so on and so forth. The moment you start getting to heating, the moment you start getting to cooling, the moment you start getting to switching a plate on, a stove or kettle on, then you're just going to run into challenges. So you've got to get the building operating at the absolute maximum efficiency. Pull that demand right down. Then you can start matching the demand by your supply side in alternative energy. And I'm not being critical of alternative energy. It's a no-brainer. We have to go in this way.
but to simply think that we can try the problem from the other side by doing number 10 first isn't limiting this point. Jay, I just want to finish with this. This is a project we've just completed in the Claremont area just up the road here on the way to Amanus. 411 houses at the CSR together with the Department of Science and Technology, working with the municipality, looked at how can we in fact improve the sustainability of these units. You will see on these units there's a really small little 100 watt photovoltaic panels. There's two of them, so there's one for each house for the duplexes. There's a small solar water heater on the roof. It's a gravity fed 90 liter unit. And if you look at the front of the house, you'll see a 2,000 liter rainwater tank for harvesting the water. Very modest. But let's have a look at what happens when you start doing the calculations. Energy reduction, heating and cooling, 11 gigajoules per house. The CO2 reduction, because here on this particular building we saved over a ton of concrete, is over a half a ton of carbon dioxide per house. Material waste reduction by designing the house with zero waste in mind. We saved 18 tons of material per house. Water from those materials, 19 cubic meters. Water through the rain drain, 22 cubic meters. Here, what's important about this is when we start saying, if this is what is possible per house, what would happen if we apply this to the 2.2 million low-income housing backlog? And let's look at the thing. Suddenly, your energy reduction for heating and cooling goes to 23 million gigajoules. Your carbon dioxide reduction, 1.4 million tons of carbon dioxide emissions eliminated. Your material waste reduction, 39 million tons. Water, 41 million cubic meters of water. Water through that rainwater harvesting tank, 46 million cubic meters of water through the rainwater tank. And then let's look at the electricity saving from the solar water heater. Very modest solar water heater, 3.7 billion kilowatt hours per annum. Electricity from a very modest 100 watt photovoltaic panel, 75 million kilowatt hours. And when you start looking at the CO2 reduction from those two interventions, you're looking at 4.4 million kilowatt hours per kilowatt hour per annum. Chair, what the message of this is that government itself has a fantastic opportunity through its social infrastructure delivery program to achieve significant energy reduction, significant energy efficiencies, and in fact to progress to net zero buildings, if it wants to. A coordinated effort on behalf of government just around the 2.2 million houses. And I'm not beginning to talk about schools, clinics, police stations, hospitals, all the rest of the stuff that we do. When you start looking at this and you apply it on a square meter rate, the potential is enormous. So with that, I conclude my presentation. I'm happy, obviously, to engage with the committee and yourself, Chair, around any questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor Van Beek. It's not the first time you've resisted, but we passed it, obviously. But you've done it again, and we've, aptly conceptualized this. Honourable members, over and above sending out the advert, there were a number of direct invitations that I sent. One of them, if I remember, I hope I'm actually, because I'm on record, was public works back then. Because it could have been very helpful for that to indicate that Professor Van Beek, I'm triggered by your last point, because it would have been very helpful for the department on behalf of, the aggregative, to articulate to us as to how far are they. There have been a couple of articles in the media where they've expressed either their intent or, their initiatives, getting off the ground and things. But obviously, this is a journey, so it's the first step for now. I can't say we'll keep in mind that along the way, those who are not part of this session of public hearings will have to be included in a creative way, one way or another, before this committee on behalf of Parliament, crafts its own recommendations which will go into, government. For now, thank you very much. stop suddenly. Thank you very much. We have reached a stage now whereby members can go for questions, clarity seeking, and make comments. Over to you, honorable members, without the waste of time. Honorable Kumale, Kweli, Matibela, Mefekasin, and Fox.
Yes, it must be answered by one or two of the presentations at various sectors. The saving on energy efficiency, and it was the first 1,037 megawatts, and then a further probably 2,500 around about there. Now, the targets that are we've been set by ESCOM and what we probably need to achieve, and I think we need to take into consideration make growth, and we need to take into consideration the reserve margin that needs to be there. Is that not too low? Are we not setting our targets? Because I heard that already in the second year of your 1,000 that we've already exceeded. So are we not being ambitious? I think the KPIs are too low. And I think we need to look at that. And I would also like to bring...
I'm with you on that.
Okay.
I was, so rest assured you will be checked. Right. 1,000% with you, ESCOM, you better tell.
Yeah. And
if you have overachieved, why do you still keep the target almost equal to the current target? That's why I needed to say, what was the previous? Because they are saying about 1,000 in 3 years, they overachieved. Mm. But they say in the next 6 years, they will still do the same when they overachieved.
Yeah.
No. Surely, I can see you also got some academics there from the university, CSIR and things. Some number counting has come, it's got to be done. I would even invite EIUG, to help with the number counting. So it's not big, because it's important. You can tell the committee is not convinced about your target there, ESCOM. Thank you.
Yes, Chair, I think if we look at it, we've got two percentages more. It looks like we about 3% or 40% maybe set targets it too low. That's just my take. The shifting of the demand cycle and it was merely illustrated in an urban city that we would all like to live in, taking from A to B in terms and I would like to bring that into the demand side of the residential area, the 35%. And the unit, the energy, and linking it out with Mr. Van Beek's presentation of the 9.5% or the 9.5 units, I would be very interested to see how do we focus then more on the 25% and the 70% power plant losses where we need to look at? And how do we bring that into this perspective? There was a presentation in the first presentation by EIUG. We're setting the priorities and the cost analysis and what we can afford and what we cannot afford. And sometimes I think we want to do 10 things, but we cannot execute all 10 properly. And it's maybe the focus on one or two of these items. And I want to understand is that when we look at the consumption of the power, and it was 28% on, trying to remember, on business, and should we not incentivize that sector into enrolling on some of the ESCOM programs and trying to get that right? There was a graph, a circle that proved to that. and I can't get it right now. And to what extent are we had a presentation yesterday that indicated that the financial sector was also incentivizing initiative in green in by offering a 2% reduction on lending rate. How, especially if we're looking into the greener economy further upstream and towards the future and towards the building construction, how does that roll out into new initiative by government, by the World Bank, by all these funding models that are we doing? Are we creating these major incentives as well in order to get the high income and the lower and the medium income groups on board? Because if it's not going to affect my if it's not going to affect my bottom line and my expense, then I'm not going to do that. And if I'm going to make a loan at the bank for R1 million and I'm going to pay prime, and I can pay prime minus 2 or 3 in reducing it maybe to 20% or 30% uptake of green products, or the in a type of a sliding scale which can be probably guaranteed. Are we having those type of initiatives? I'm not so sure. But yeah, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you to the presenters. I think it has been a very enlightening morning. To my concern, I'm glad that you said that we don't really have a strategy, because that's been my contention all along. I don't think we've given energy efficiency the kind of priority in terms of actually strategizing and modeling for it the way that it should be done. And the reason why I say that as well is if I look at the IRP, for instance, and I compare IRPs that have been done around the world, the way that other IRPs deal with energy efficiency measures is that they actually model those in terms of the cost to put in energy efficiency compared to building the power station. And they actually do that modeling process and then say, right, we need to spend this much on energy efficiency, this much on building. Whereas I don't feel that he's done that in this present IRP. And in fact, when I look at the IRP, it talks about savings of 3,200 megawatts over the next 20 years. Now when I listen to ESCOM, they say they've saved over 1,000 megawatts. They plan to save 2,500 megawatts in the next 6 years. That's already more than what's contained in the IRP. So clearly, we haven't been ambitious enough in the present IRP, and we should be re-looking at those figures to see how, you know, what kind of fact base can we base it on, and what can we really make a target for energy efficiency over the next 20 years. And I think that when you revise the IRP, that's something that we really need to look at. And I'll just be interested to hear your comments on that. Then I wanted to ask, when you talk about differentiating between the different sectors, I think that is right. I also think that we need a differentiation between a long-term strategy and a short-term strategy. And I think that our kind of short-term strategy right now is largely about reducing the peak demand. I mean, that's where the real crisis is. If that 3,000 megawatt peak demand, how do we reduce that? And what are the interventions that are going to do that? And one of the discussions we had yesterday was about time of use meters. And I'd just be interested to hear from ESCOM's side as to whether you think we should be looking at a mass rollout of time-of-use meters. Clearly, this has to be done by municipalities, and it's largely in their interest as well. But who would fund such a program? What would the cost of such a program be? And would it deliver the kinds of savings that you think is necessary? I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on that. And then from the CSIR's point of view, your presentation is particularly inspiring. I think it's precisely the kinds of rethinking that we need to, it's the kind of rethinking and the kind of redesigning our world that we need to be conceptualizing over the long term. And when you talk about a kind of self-sufficient house or even a green class building, I'm sorry to bring this up, but you know, a friend of mine actually has a backpack as well in the Eastern Cape, which is complete off the grid, both in terms of water and in terms of electricity. The one thing though that they seem to struggle with, and it seems to be a problem in rural areas where there's no grid connected electricity, is in fact refrigeration. They find that they have to run the refrigeration off gas, and gas is extremely expensive for refrigeration. Is there any solutions that have been presented around energy efficient refrigeration that we could be looking at? Because I know that in some parts of the rural areas, some households can spend up to about R700 on gas in terms of keeping their food cold. So I'd just be interested to hear what your solutions are there. Thank you.
Uh,
Matt, I don't know who was first now. Member Tillett.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you for the wonderful presentation that you had this morning. They're quite inspiring and quite enlightening people. When we talk of a water scarce country, South Africa, I think the CSIR is coming up with a wonderful thing of having water harvesting. This water harvesting is really what we really need, and it's something that we have to teach people out, especially in the rural areas. Because when it rains, the water just goes to nowhere. And yet we don't even have got water to water our small vegetable garden. That's a very good idea. I just wanted to ask on page about the material on page, not numbered. Material extraction and manufacturing, where you talk about the cement, the steel, aluminium, clay, and all this. Can you please elaborate? I didn't get this very clearly. How should people build their houses when you can't use this? The other one is to ESCO about the 700 teachers which you taught. Where can you come up with the provinces where those teachers are coming from? Are they coming from one province or just one school or whatever? And I also want to know about the downlighting of the 700 homes, which you visited, so that sometime we can perhaps go and have an oversight there and verify ourselves as a commission. Thank you, sir. I'll come.
My pleasure.
Thanks very much, Chair. I'm also just agreeing with Uncle Smari about a target of ESCOM, and you said that it's half a target being too low. And then, of course, you know, the whole thing about us not having a strategy, it's a little bit scary when you, at the beginning of this oversight, said that certainly energy efficiency would be the flagship of this committee. And there's just so much that I listened to this morning that was really wonderful. Amazing presentation, thought-provoking presentation, but a lot of work to be done. Professor Van Dijk certainly turned the way one needs to look at the energy efficiency on its head. Obviously, a lot of opportunities for government, but obviously, it's a lot of intergovernmental conversations that have to take place, and it would be great to see what public works is really doing. I'd like to just ask him whether there's been any engagement with human settlements. And of course, as a member of the committee, we would like to see these different things that they've done in Claymont and at the CSIR, the house that they put up, to see how this really, really works. Concern, you made mention of climate change, and we're looking at 4% interior and 3% exterior. How is our government really looking at that? And we asked a question about the material extraction. I'm really just interested, I'm sure it's dependent on fossil fuel, and I'm just interested what the actual cost is around that. Then, just around Eskom, all of the same question around about the training, the trainer program. What kind of numbers are we looking at? And do you have a measurement as to how successful this initiative has been? And what kind of mechanisms are used to measure this? I'm specifically talking about training the trainer. What kind of young people are coming out of there, and he's asked about the different provinces, and certainly we'd like to know about that. Then the other question also to ask him was about the job creation, and it was really looking at the different, I'm just trying to find the slide, the different, or the various tenders that come into the organization, and one looks at the job creation and certainly job skills or upskilling. Is there any kind of measurement? How many jobs have really been created out here, or is this just a recycling of jobs? Because obviously we are looking at job creation in this age, and we're looking certainly at upskilling. And how are we upskilling people? Are people just staying at lower levels? I'm just trying to find one or two of my other questions I've written down. And unfortunately, we write it down as we're going through our presentation, we write things down. I also had a question, I think it was Honorable Heinle asked him, about what is it going to cost? What would this mass rollout from Eskom, how is it going to be funded, and what would it cost to us, and would it cost the consumer in the end? I have asked about the job creation. I think that's all for now. One last question, interest skill. I have to say the adverts on TV are really, they powerful adverts, and I see them. I always go and check to see if we've got anything on at home that I need to speed up. I really do that. But just a provocative question is, what is the actual savings in terms of Eskom? I'm talking about financial monetary savings in relation to that marketing expenditure. It's a question.
A little bit provocative question. Thank you very much. Thanks, Chair, for now.
Thank you, Chair. I'll start with Eskom. Eskom is on page 10. It's referring to, was referring to difficulty in approaching high income homes. To scale those walls and do what have you. I want to tell you the platform to go through those walls, through the platform of Parliament. I'm trying to get from you the real distance to what is it that we need to tell these high-income people so that we start taking that information out. Because I'm trying to, even if we have to say what you are saying, to me it could have just one purpose, to say, let us go out there, whatever we take off that from here in Parliament. Let us try to go through those ones. On page 11, I'm still with Eskom. I'm curious about the residential sector, residential mass rollout program. I'm putting my constituency cap here, coming from those rural areas. I'm trying to get a better understanding of what practically does this mean. Is this something that the people in the rural areas in a cap can apply in a different way when they are building their own houses? What is it that you advise them to do? The solar heater, I constantly refer to this in all these meetings because I have. But I'm still not sure whether I'm benefiting out of it. And I'm still wanting someone to say, yes, this is a good thing to do. This is how you benefit. On again, Eskom on page 12, it refers to C0 and localization. Again, I'm putting my constituency middle repair. When Eskom is having this skill development, is it confined somewhere? Is it nationwide? Is there anything that I can do for my constituents to say, when it comes up of stealing, among other things, is what you need to be doing? On page 16, I'm still with Eskom. In conclusion, Eskom said, any significant changes to the current government and funding of energy efficiency projects will create undue risk to the security of supply in the current constrained electricity system. I'm trying to get more of that because we are here to address that thing. what actually does that mean? What is it that we need to do in order to assist PESCO so that it does not have this double affect the country generally? I cross over to CSIR. CSIR, I think it's basically almost the same question as ESCO. I'm interested in this new type of building out the current government. And CSIR had his, what you refer to as a passive house. And this to me means it's something that needs to be taken out of CSIR implemented in our rural areas. Practically, what does that mean? And I was even more interested in CSIR when on slide 6, small scale solution. When you are in the rural areas where some of us come from, you want to have your sewage or whatever. I don't know whether this is kind of something that you can use there. You have people even with water only using pit latrines. And if they want to cross over, even if they have all these water tanks, they don't have the expertise and understanding of what is it that they need to do in order to get. Is this the kind of a solution that one can use in the whole area? How does it work? I'm also one of those who are interested in that kind of one. So that even if the government does not do it, our constituencies, if they can, are able to do it. I was also curious at that lack of strategy. Even as a committee, we are told that there is no strategy. Who need to come up with strategy? Let's change that from a question to something faster. When we come out of here, who do we try to provoke to make sure that from now on, we are busy with all 3 or 6 months so that we have what we can call a strategy for the whole country? Thank you, sir.
Who was the first IG? Okay. So, what is the government and strategy? I have me quite a thick document. 40 pages of energy efficiency strategy of the Republic of South Africa by the Department of Energy. We got out in March 2005, but the date March 2005. Are you referring to that you have criticism? Because it's important that we be clear. You know, there is a document, and this is what honorable members this is what we expect to have been revised by the close of last year. The first department committed. Let's have that on record. The department committed that by the close of last year we have had this statement revised. And if you remember, also, if I can just remind you, honourable members, on the 11th of August last year, we also had a session on energy efficiency and energy savings. And the question of this energy strategy was triggered around that meeting. So, how do we handle this situation? And we saw that it's going to be revised, and we're going towards the end. I mean, it's almost a year now, let alone it's even going close to a year beyond the target. I think it's important that we put that in record. From our side, as you call me, but so just to say, are you referring on this? Is your criticism uneasiness around the existing strategy? If so, where and how? I'm even looking at the targets that are being set there. The overall target is 12% by 2015 on industrial mining, power, or electrical use, buildings, both commercial and public, all 15%. And residential down to 9-10% and transport down to, residential 10%, transport 9% by 2015. Those are the targets. Now, I'm raising this that I challenge that because from my level, I would have assumed on the smaller that they're going to have to figure without having done some number crunching
Professor Van Dyck, well, you're welcome to join the party, and Professor Shia and your colleague when make a presentation, you get lots of comments on this. Because it's important for us as generalists, as a public representatives, to be assisted, you know. New figures can come, but what is the basis of that? You know, IUG has triggered this, and surely the whole community of respect, you know, academic, has got to assist us, as I say, you know, there must be some PA in the action for that accuracy. The other area I want to take up with the IUG is the public participation and worker participation. So that's very important. You are interested in it. And your presentation, your idea, your vision, it's really outstanding. But just on those two pillars, what extent do you envisage integrating your work with the public participation, awareness campaign, or roadshows, or whatever? Because it's important. It can't just be confined to boardrooms and laboratories. And go into your room, you have to go out there in the park, you know. I'm even, you know, by your market segmentation where you see the various of levels of energy saving, you know, in the three market segments. Worker participation is at the end of the day, the person who switches off the machine, either the person who puts on a machine or whatever, the person who stops a leak, or who knows that if a machine is overused or whatever, you know, the worker, and how do you ensure that you integrate the worker in the overall energy efficient use? That's very, 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 you know, fundamental. The ESCOM, I've already indicated the first one, that the implications of overachievement. That's very, very important. And I must highlight also, I'm keen to see how the international benchmarking proceeds. Because that's also going to be very helpful, but of course, we would like to see countries which have a similar economic configuration like ours. So I did raise some concerns yesterday, and as Thomas said, if you could just comment on that. Also, although it was very, very jovial, but the issue of thermoelectrical principles and technology, I'm turning that to EIUG as well. There's a lot of heat on account. Is it too much to turn that and use it for power? CSIR, any R&D in that area, I mean, I understand we don't have much geothermal, but still, if some variant, if I can put it crude, of the geothermal, because there's a lot of heat. Lastly, ESCOM, you recently got to your roadshows and awareness campaign. What is the role of regional forum, which you once alluded to? Something you made a presentation that you've got various regional forums. It would be very helpful. Any government buy-in in your work? Because the paradigm shift in thinking, it goes right into the next frontier. And you know, human beings can resist. I'll leave it there. Human beings can resist. So I'm interested in the buy-in. Also, with regards to integrated urban development, it's a very striking thing. Am I correct or stretching it too far if I think one of the tools that can make it that work is smart grid? It's a very, very striking tool when a certain facility is not using you know, energy, but it shifts it to where energy is utilized, you know. It's a very interesting question. How would it work? Just a technical issue for anyone to help there. I think it was CSIR, probably, was written here. Ventilation and cooling. are those two different things? Because I see you have given two presentations, if you could just ask on that. Can we give the, we've really bombarded with a lot of questions. Can we take a break while we're preparing for the presenters, allowing the presenters to prepare their responses? I'll be unfortunately strict this time because we are overshooting our time limit. The matter that we don't just get up on to the thank you. Over to CSIR. Thank you. Chair, thank you very much for your indulgence. I don't want to hijack your meeting, Chair, sir, but I appreciate the fact you've given us a chance to respond. Chair, if I can just deal with questions, there's 10 questions as I receive them. The first one around refrigeration, a major challenge. The issues of cooking, anything to do with the service element, resistant heating, very problematic, and then refrigeration is a major challenge. We are seeing significant gains in terms of performance. So the equipment, the five-star rated equipment, is getting very, very much better. Just recently, we started discussing with our counterparts in Denmark, the Finnish Technology Institute, who developed a fridge that actually works off solar power. They developed it for the African market for medicines. There are medicines that need to be kept cold in clinics around Africa, and so they developed this fridge that can actually run off solar power. And we're curious about what that would mean at scale, and we'll pursue that. But yes, it is a problem. The second question, if around the extracted materials, if these materials are problematic, are people supposed to build their buildings? Chair, there's five technology pillar strategy that we're running out at CSR. The first is to look at your conventional materials. How can we improve processes? You heard ESCOM talking about their discussions with the manufacturing industry. Each industry has got its own set of potentialities around achieving energy efficiencies in the production process, so clearly those need to be exploited. Then you start moving into fringe technologies that are alternative ways of making materials, conventional materials that are up there, but the uptake isn't very significant. Corob, for example, one of the major brick manufacturers in South Africa, is pursuing quite a lot of that in completely reinstalling their kilns in their production processes to more efficient processes using technologies that have been around, but the pressure point has not really been there to engage with it. The third technology is around hybrid technologies, and I think that's really where South Africa needs to look at, where you can start combining conventional fringe and new technologies and producing hybrid opportunities. And then we move into biotechnologies, which is the bio-based natural fiber composite materials, and ultimately nanotechnology, which is probably a long way down the line. But yeah, they are obviously low-hanging fruit. Let me give you an example. Predominantly, we make use of concrete blocks in low-income housing, and to make the cement is an energy-intensive process. There is another process called aerated concrete, which does two things. It predominantly reduces the cement content by replacing the cement with fly ash and bottom ash from power stations. And then it goes through a manufacturing process that requires steam, so it actually heats it up through steam to produce the block. So the energy efficiencies around that are incredible. Here's the rub. The two things that Eskom does, apart from supplying energy, it produces waste steam and it produces fly ash. And nothing is no petrol. There's a company that wants to establish aerated concrete plant at ESCOM production process, where it can tap into the waste steam and use the fly ash to make blocks that we use for building low-income housing. And this is like trying to move a tanker with your small finger. But essentially, you're using waste byproduct to make a material, which is the predominant material in resolving some of the infrastructure issues in South Africa. And that's the kind of thinking that we need to exploit. How do we start using byproducts and waste products to solve our problems? Because they're there. The solutions, opportunities are there. It's not a question of finding solutions, but they're there. It's a question of finding the will to put it together. Chair, the issue around engaging with human settlements, as you've just been advised, we in fact are making a presentation to human settlements this morning. We have had the executive committee, the EG of human settlements, with the entire executive team on human settlements at our site. We've shown them the work that we're doing.
The project in Tenmont is a human settlements project. Interventions were funded by DST in terms of the science and technologies. So that was really an intergovernmental exercise in terms of looking at how can we progress into delivering sustainable human settlement. So that is an ongoing conversation we're having with them. In terms of the issues around material extraction and the cost implications, I don't have the figures for it. We know that these are plentiful materials. There's a cost in the extraction process, there's a cost in the manufacturing process. A major component of that is the energy, the production. How do you convert the raw material into a final product? So that's really where you start looking for opportunities, and to the extent that you find those opportunities, you start reducing those costs. Let me, for example, just say, I mentioned in the presentation, Chair, that you're looking at temperature anywhere between 1,500 degrees to 3,000 degrees. The 3,000 degrees is very problematic to find an alternative for that. But at the 1,500 degree level or the 1,000 degree level, which some materials use, a bigger plant, and typically your brick manufacturers would be in that category, could afford to set up a CSP plant, concentrated solar power plant, which would provide an 800 degrees. So the extra 200 or 300, 400 degrees, they would then have to find off the rest. But they could essentially meet a substantial chunk of the energy demand by setting up a CSP plant. And we're talking at a scale. So these are big manufacturers. The scale is sufficient to warrant that kind of investment. The technology is there. It's again being used. The question around the passive house, Chair, what I would like to do, to the extent that I'm in a position to do it, and I'll take a hiding if I'm out of line here, is to invite your committee to come to CSR and to look at the work that we're doing on the innovation site. We are testing alternative technologies, Chair. Energy efficiency is part of that exercise. Fundamentally, what we are is a technology institute. So we are trying to find ways of delivering homes rather than houses. And part of that is creating a sustainable human settlement and a comfortable living environment. So, Chair, let me extend that as easy to represent CSR at Parliament. At any time that you and your committee wish to come through, please let us know and come and see the work that we're doing. We have erected a house which is a completely passive house. As I said, we are monitoring it on a 24/7, 365 basis, 50-minute intervals to see how it performs, because we think that is the benchmark that would serve South Africa. So small-scale solutions is the it. I think in terms of moving forward at the health environment level, Chair, there isn't a municipality in the world that is coping with infrastructure. Not one. There's a possible exception of Singapore. And what's interesting about Singapore is it's a city-state. But every single municipality in the United States, infrastructure quality in the United States has gone from a C minus to a D plus over the last 5 years, Chair. It is still the most affluent, still wealthiest economy in the world. And they cannot manage the infrastructure. So we have to find a different model. Chair, do you want to make an intervention?
What's C minus, D plus?
The category where A is like fantastic and E or F is a fail. So it's a category that they use to measure the level of infrastructure across a basket of matrices. And it's gone from C minus to a D plus. So it's actually going backwards. It's a deteriorating share. And so the challenge with cities in a developing country like South Africa, how do we do it? And you have to find alternative ways of doing it. And relieving burden on municipality is one of those alternative ways. So looking at small-scale solutions is to me, the genie in a bottle kind of thing. Okay, just in terms of that, we are currently working with DST in a rural project in KZN in Newton, where we are looking to put up a small-scale human settlement completely off-grid. The community will have flushing water tanks, flushing toilets, even though there's no water. They will have a proper sewage system, even though there isn't a sewer. They will have lights. They will have water, even though there isn't water and there isn't electricity. As a test to see to what extent can we, in fact, begin to engage in rural communities to provide off-grid communities. And we're hoping to start that work, in fact, in within a month, we should move on to the site of the contractor. Chair, you asked a question around geothermal. One of my jobs is to chair the energy efficiency standards of the South African Bureau of Standards. It's SANS 204 and 10400 by XA. And that is an issue that we currently have under evaluation, Chair, to see to what extent geothermal presents opportunities. There's conflicting evidence about its efficacy, and we are trying to get on top of it. In fact, the emails are flying as we speak. Chair, your question around government buy-in.
And I need to again be careful. But the challenge that any government faces is how do you begin to coordinate these things across governmental structures? I give you the case of the Claremont housing chair. It's not just a Hume settlement. To the extent that we start solving energy issues at Claremont, we stop solving your committee's problem, the Department of Energy's problem, the government's problem around energy. To the extent that you stop solving water problems at Claremont, you solve the Department of Water Affairs problem around water, you solve the government's issue around water. Each one of those has implication on a government department, and each one of those addresses national imperatives. To the extent that you unpack the way we put projects together, you begin to tick government national imperative across departments. But we conceptualize at a bulk level. When we say we need water, we build a huge dam. When we say we need power, we build a huge power station. Instead of saying, is it possible to start at the heart of the other side of the problem and see to what extent we can reduce burden, not just on the beneficiary, because those folk in Claremont will have benefit of life for the rest of their life for free. They will have 34,000 litres of water every year for free. That also means that the municipality doesn't have to reticulate water to those houses. It also means that the municipality doesn't have to send electricity to those houses. It also means that the municipality doesn't have to send bills to those houses and collect the revenue from those houses, because they are getting those services for free. The people who have the least amount of money to pay are getting services for free for the rest of their lives. One lady has in fact taken the rainwater tank and connected it to a washing machine. Incredibly innovative. But it's unpacking the problem from the other side of the telescope. So when you start saying to all the government departments, is there a way of solving our collective problem in a project form, then you start unlocking the opportunity. And that turns to your question around integrated urban development. In a sense, we have a fantastic opportunity. It's a real negative, but it's an opportunity. Most of African cities are laboring under a town planning scheme that probably dates back to the 1950s. So when you start looking at mixed developments, almost inevitably the developer has to make an application to rezone that land from whatever it was to whatever they want to use. The land use planning ordinance grants a local authority the opportunity of saying, you need to provide the following if you want the rezoning. And that following typically has been, you need to widen the road, you need to provide intersection, you need to the traffic scene, the lights up, and da-da-da. The opportunity in our chair could be, you need to be 20%, 30%, 40% of grid. If you want to develop, you need to find ways of not making your development a burden on the local authority, a burden on government, because the technology exists to do it. And that integrated urban environmental model would be one of those models. Another Rose Arch, Johannesburg, classic, could be doing this. It's a mixed development. There's residential buildings, there's office buildings, there's recreational buildings. They could be swappy services. So you could actually use a current ordinance and the town planning scheme to drive behavior. Lastly, the ventilation and cooling, yes. Ventilation is just if you wanted to make sure that in a room such as this, well, the windows are closed, and you wanted to keep the air fresh, you would just circulate air. The temperature outside is actually very nice today. So in this particular space, you don't need good air conditioning. You don't need to cool that air because the outside air is more than sufficient. You could actually just circulate. So ventilation is just moving air through the space. The cooling or heating is the air outside is too cold, so we need to warm it. Classically, the temperature today is around about 19 degrees. You might be looking for 20, 21, 22 degrees, so you may want to warm it. Or in summer, the air outside is 30 degrees, and you're looking for 20 degrees inside, so you've got to cool it. But to the extent that you actually use outside air, you reduce that burden, the temperature of the outside, and you reduce the amount of heating or cooling that you need to put into a space. So it all goes back to design. Now, there are solar-driven air conditioning systems. We use solar energy to heat. That's a no-brainer. It's the easiest thing to do. But using a refrigeration principle, you can actually do the same thing in reverse. You can use solar power to cool. Some kind of crazy. You use heat to make cool, but that's how fridge works. So you can actually start moving into systems where your heating and cooling is taken care of by solar energy.
So that's the response to the questions. If I can just beg your indulgence with the observations, my invitation to you, sir, to bring your committee to CSR. By the same token, we can invite you to Claymont. It might be very useful for your committee to just actually look at what happens at the human settlement scale when you start putting these energy efficiency interventions in place and talk to the beneficiaries about how they're experiencing it. So Chair, just be ahead with the CSR option and we can facilitate that. A major challenge, Chair, in South Africa around energy efficiency is the benchmarking. You heard members asking questions about numbers. I have a concern as Chair of the Standard Committee. And we've put some numbers into the building regulations around what the energy consumption we think a building should be. I don't want to say it's a thumbs up, but it's not a thumbs up. But I must tell you that I have a low level of confidence that we've got the right numbers. And the reason I say that is because we don't have a benchmark. We don't know what buildings do in Cape Town, in Durban, in Johannesburg, in Bloemfontein. How office buildings operate, how the churches operate, how the hospitals operate, how the hospitals. There isn't a one-size-fits-all. And my concern is, yes, we undoubtedly are going to get benefits from the building regulations, but my concern is when the construction industry and the property market turns, we could wipe out all that gain simply by the expansion that occurs. So benchmarking is, in my view, one of the critical components that we need to put in place so that we understand where we are, and then we can work out a way to get to where we want to be. But when you say, I want to be there, but you actually don't know where you are, it's a bit like Alice in Wonderland. It doesn't matter which way you go because the answer is going to be rubbish anyway. So we really do need to establish a baseline for the country in order for us to plot a way forward and be able to measure consistently each year. Are we progressing or do we need to increase the targets? Do we need to tighten up the lines? Do we need to push the industry to perform better and better? So if I could leave you with a plea from my side. Intergovernmental coordination is just critical. We need to get all the role players around the table to unpack government's own opportunities around its infrastructure development program, to exploit the opportunities where government's infrastructure program can begin to address national imperatives. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Professor Van Wyk. Intergovernmental coordination and baseline and benchmarking of energy data by building. We're taking out of that and ESCOM, you might as well take note of the fact that there's this fly ash and steam issue. Of course, we're not going to pressurize you to respond now if you feel uneasy, but if you can do so, but if you can't, that homework will come back to us. Obviously, one of the fundamentals on efficient utilization of resources is actually waste management, or recycling in particular. Thanks so much, and tell an Honorable Dambuza that definitely there's a joint initiative between us and her committee in making. We'll be in touch with them. I thank you. Entering back now to EIUG and ESCOM.
Chair, would you wish me to respond? I've made most of the things I think that were addressed to ourselves. I think before I do that, let me just commend Professor Hall for two issues that he said, which I did highlight in my presentation, and he said it at the end in quite a long response. But he acknowledges that there's a lack of data, which cuts to the core of the reason why I said that we don't have a strategy, but I will explain to your question. And he also appealed for proper and better integration between ministries. This is one of the biggest failures, reasons for failure of policy implementation. The one observation I would make, though, with regards to R&D and the various excellent ideas put forward by the professor, is that we also need to consider fit for purpose, particularly in the South Africa context. But then, let me just respond then, one at a time to the questions. And I apologize, Chair, if it's not in the right sequence, but if it isn't, I'm sure you'll correct me for that. And members, just bear with me, please. One of the questions that were put to us earlier, and I think it was you, Chair, that we as the EIUG stand available and are ready to assist government in any way we can with regards to the data and the number crunching as you refer to it. I would also just emphasize, Chair, this is an expertise which we have, which I know government do not have, that as large business and industry, we specialize. We work in number crunching and information and data. So we put it on the line that we are ready and available to support the Ministry, in particular the Department of Energy, but anyone, as we also do for the Department of Environment Affairs. Honourable Member Small made the comment with regard to, he was referring to the prioritisation of things. I fully support and agree with his comments that we're trying to do everything, but we actually do nothing. This also is the reason why I say we do not have a strategy. So we have ad hoc responses to issues of what is important on the particular day, rather than a well-considered prioritised plan. So I fully support the fact that if there was a proper strategy, we would not have this, at this stage, question what is important and what's not important. There was a comment with regards to the request of green investments. Well, the only comment I have about the incentive programs, whether it's from the financial sector or from government or anything else, is if you remember in my presentation, I said we need to review the order and efficacy of policy priorities. And this is a situation where certain policies are put into place before the actual plan is in place. And I'm going to give you one example. The National Treasurer are continuously talking about introducing a carbon tax. And our argument to it is not yes or no. We're saying, where does it fit into the strategy? And they can't answer that question because we do not yet have a fully rolled out carbon budgeting process. So it's a situation where, again, ministries are not coordinating, and then we have a situation where there's policy incoherence. then I think, and I'm going to respond to this as I go through it, but just bear with me. I think it was Honourable Member Khalen who posed the question, no strategy. I think he said he agreed with it. Well, let me emphasize here, I have to say emphatically, we do not have strategy. If you remember, I said you've got to consider this answer in the context of all things. You cannot have a strategy without a fact base. You cannot have a strategy without considering very carefully whether you have doable, practical, or realistic, or ambitious, sufficiently objectives. We've heard on numerous occasions today and questioning the issues of objectives. Have they been properly considered? Do they have context? Are they based on facts? And the answer virtually consistently from not only myself but other members around the table is no. And I'm going to be illustrated by another question posed by Honourable Member Freyling, where he asked about the IFP. And he's right. And I happen to know the details around this issue. Now, the problem with this issue of energy efficiency, and quite frankly, many of the things raised by the Prof, is we are living in a situation because of the sequencing of policy. And I'm just going to give you the ideal process. The ideal process, Chair, right now, we should have had in our position the Integrated Energy Plan of South Africa. Chair, we don't have it yet. Yet we have an IFP. We're now talking about an energy efficiency strategy. The policy that combines, aligns, and streamlines all these policies is the energy integrated energy plan. We don't have it yet. I'm not blaming anybody. I'm just saying it doesn't exist. So consequently, any policy that is done pre the integrated energy plan has to second guess and has to try and compensate for lack of other policies which are presented by other instruments. So, for example, the energy efficiency should be an integral part of the integrated energy plan, which should then inform as an input to the integrated electricity plan or the IRP. So we are confronted here, and I'm not saying that's right or wrong, it's just reality, but we need to recognize it. So to comment about the IRP's energy efficiency targets, I agree with Honourable Member Khalen that they were certainly not correct because there wasn't sufficient facts and information to inform. Ideally, what we should have had is the IEP, a proper energy efficiency strategy which informed a proper energy efficiency campaign with targets and objective set, which we discussed today. That should have been an input to the IRP process. Unfortunately, none of those existed, so the IRP had to compensate and make certain assumptions. So I think this is a practical example of what the Prof mentioned when he said, please, can't we integrate better policy environment? So I just emphasize it in that context. With regards to the Honourable Member's question about is the solar water heater working? Here's another example of policy incoherence. I'm very saddened to tell you today, Chair, the reason the solar water heater is not going to give them financial benefits. We have just completed a study of the way in which the municipalities are charging people electricity. So just to quickly explain how this is done. When you buy electricity, the municipalities calculate on two components. The energy component, or if you will, the equivalent of what energy you consume, and what they call the maximum demand or the fixed charges. That's the cost they should be charging in terms of recovering what it cost them to provide you a meter, cables, etc., etc. And what the municipalities have been doing is the energy charges are more or less in line with what NERSA regulates. But I'm sad to say that the maximum demand charges, which are fixed charges, by the way, are in cases orders of magnitude above what Eskom are charging and, in fact, what they should be charged in terms of NERSA regulations. So this is what happens. You install a solar water heater, you get very small benefits. The fixed charges stand and don't go away because it's built into your price. So we need to get this right. I think the municipalities, in terms of the way they're charging, are killing commerce and killing light industry, and in fact making it impossible for the residential users to afford that electricity. That's why I agree with the Prof when he said maybe we should be looking at simpler alternate solutions. But this issue of the municipal tariffs here, I put you, is a recipe for social unrest, lack of service delivery, and also the reason why the investment in solar water heaters is not going to be seen in the pocket of the end user. Then I think we come to the issue that I think you raised, Chair, and I'm very glad that you did, about who should write the strategy. Now, two things. I just wanted to check, Enrico, that we did make submissions of two written papers. The one was a critique which we were asked. I'm going to give you just date because you raised this question, Chair. We were asked last year to submit a critique on the current so-called strategy, the white paper that you referred to. And it's a small document which we gave you. And in there, I summarized exactly what the problems are with the so-called strategy, because it's not that. It's not a strategy. But we said we can't just criticize. We need to make a suggestion. We then went out and secured funding from one of the best consultancies that do this work worldwide. And they drafted, which we've also shared with you, it's a document called A Recommended National Approach to Integrated Efficiency Strategy. That document, in our opinion, can be put out for public comment. And it can be put up very quickly because it's informed by international best practice, but it's been moderated to South African conditions. And we will have in our hands a proper strategy in very short space of time. So hopefully I'm answering a few questions that were asked. One, we are prepared to stand behind and assist the department if necessary with it, because it's not policy. We're not interfering with government policy. Chair, I put to you that data information and presenting a properly informed strategy is not policy work. It's technical work. And we're happy to assist in that. Government has the prerogative to set objectives. That's the government prerogative. We do not wish to interfere with that. And they have the prerogative to select the best strategy. That's policy work. So if we can separate this so-called conflict between business and government, so we here, as citizens of South Africa, we want to come up with a solution that's good for SA Inc., not for business, not for any particular electoral interest, but we need to do the best for the country, and we're happy to put our name behind anything that, in fact, furthers the goal of SA Inc. So with regards to the strategy, we have shared with you a document which we believe represents the proper strategy, and I welcome the members to look at it, and if they have questions or yourself, Chair, we're happy to make a further presentation, and in fact happy to engage with the Department of Energy on that as well, because we think that document is in fact a proper strategy. As far as the existing document, you may ask, why is it not a strategy? If you look at the ABCD that I shared with you, you will find predominantly the document that is called the so-called strategy is predominantly objectives and so-called aspirations with some issues. There is very little substantive fact base to the extent that I issued earlier, and therefore if you don't have the facts, the question is what were the objectives based. Those objectives and targets in that document were not based on consultation and certainly not on deep level information of the facts and information. And then also, in the document, I challenge you to find a so-called roadmap, the one that I showed as an example in my presentation. Without such a roadmap, you don't have clear lines of accountability, responsibility, due dates, and deliverables spelled out in big, pristine, and clear detail. So unless that is done, I fear, Chair, that we will continue to hear in another year's time that we said these objectives had to be met, but they weren't met. But with a proper strategy document, this committee and the ministry and, in fact, government at large will be able to say, we said we were going to do that, we did it, it's done, move on to the next thing. Chair, then also you mentioned a very important point about public participation. As business, we are actively involved in public participation, and I talk particularly in the mining sector with our CFI programs, the community social investment programs. And the reason for this is I think the mining industry is very well placed in the rural areas, because that's where our mines are, to interact with the local community and the leadership, which we do on an ongoing basis. And in fact, the issue of energy and off-grid energy is a big component. So, for example, if we sit down with the community and we identify the need, let's say, for a clinic, we would, in the first instance, look at it will totally self-sustained facilities, whether it's sewage, water, and power. So it's an integral part of public participation, but I acknowledge that we can do more and better, and I'll take note of your comments. In regards to work of anticipation, it's also a program that we're dealing with on an ongoing basis, and I think, correctly, Chair, you highlighted the issue of wastage and leakages and so on. But I think on that part, I have to acknowledge that we must do much more. We're not doing sufficient. I fully accept that that's an area that we need to raise our game. The last comment that I had here was the question with regards to underground heating, and I noted what the prop is. But just to quickly illustrate why at the moment is a significant balance. One, the heat where it exists in terms of so-called geothermal heat sources is deep. It's well over 2 kilometers underground. Most geothermal stations around the world are only a few hundred meters deep, and so you can extract that heat fairly efficiently. In the case of ourselves, it's 2+ kilometers deep, so it's very deep. Secondly, the rock face temperature down at the underground, whilst they're hot for obviously humans, they're not clearly hot enough for the extraction of so-called that heat that makes us there, because if you look at geothermal, it's very much hotter than in fact in our particular deep level gold mine. So there is a contrast. I'm not suggesting it's impossible, but technology at the moment makes it an extremely difficult means or source of extracting fuel energy through that heat source. Jay, I hope I've answered all the points that were put to me. If I haven't, I think the only comment I had was on refrigeration, and I fully agree with the prof that at the moment the technology is fully available. We can in this country do rural cooling and refrigeration with a combination of PV and solar generated energy for refrigeration. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Member, so much for our efforts to look at rural energy, or to keep that in mind when we look at rural energy, because at some stage we need to just invest time on rural energy in its totality. We started LBC in January, but obviously that's just the taste, and as you can see, we're beginning to get more and more issues, so that with the department, obviously, we can engage and see how to advance rural energy, per se. Thank you very much, Efon.
Thank you, Chair. I think there was a unanimous call for Eskom targets to be higher on energy efficiency, and Chair, that point is well taken. What I would mention is that in order for ourselves as a country to become more energy efficient and to pursue a bigger amount, it's not just about the incentive program which ISCOM has in place. I think there are other measures as well which we need to put in place as well. And these would include, for example, enforcement of the new building code, which requires that new homes to be built are built with either, effectively built with either a solar water heater or a heat pump. The appliance labeling system that would need to come into place in appliance stores, so that firstly as consumers we're educated about the energy efficient usage of the appliances we're buying, but then also we could use that same tool to ratchet up the energy efficiency by eliminating, from year to year, eliminating the worst of it. So if A is a good appliance and H is a bad appliance, then from next year you just indicate that you will no longer accept H's, and then from the next year you will no longer accept G's, etc. So there's a lot of tools that need to be put in place, but certainly we do take the point about Eskom targets. We certainly can confirm that we would need bigger savings than our current targets indicate. So I know that our regulator has joined the meeting, and I understand that they'll be making a presentation. Perhaps they could also comment on our targets. So I can confirm that we would need more, but I don't think it's just such an incentive that the incentive programs that we're running. A question about the time of use tariff across the country, and I would say that if there was one program that if we could succeed rapidly with it, a residential time of use, a rollout of residential time of use in the country, I would certainly say would be the way to go. I think, as we stand at the moment, it doesn't actually cost any more or any less whether you use electricity during peak time or off peak, and that is a major contributor to the fact that we have the very big peak that we have. Our swimming pools, our geysers, we don't care. We don't know actually as consumers. If that tariff signal were there, most certainly we would. The cost, and Honourable Fraling, Mr. Fraling, requested about the cost of that. If we were to do 1 million homes, that would cost, I would estimate,
Kenny, and also everyone, can you just try and make sure that Sarah is far away from the microphone?
Let me try. Oh, you got 3G card, sorry. Okay, sorry. Chair, the cost if we were to do managed homes would be in the order of 5 billion rand. What's important would be to focus on, once again, and it comes back to the high wall, the high wall request of the Honourable Member, and that we would need to start this program with consumers with high usage. So we're looking at consumers with 1,000 kilowatt-hours per month or more, and if we focus on the top million consumers in terms of rated over size of consumption and the technology impact, we certainly would. Of course, the cheap faster is a tariff. So Eskom has piloted a time of use tariff, but it's a peak and off-peak tariff. We've piloted that. We've also piloted the technology, and we're actually going through the learning. But we need a national strategy, and we do have fragmentation across the industry, so I totally agree with the Honourable Member's assessment of the situation. So we will be approaching government with a request for that strategy. The last question was, how would this be funded? There would be two potential ways. It would be funded through the tariff as part of Eskom's price increase application, or an adjustment to that price increase application down the line, or through the fiscus, and from there, National Treasury would then make an allocation, and that would be then administered through the Department of Energy. So it could be either way, and we've got programs running at the moment which in fact funded, different programs are funded through different mechanisms, but the mechanisms are there, we just need to use the pilots. But certainly that would require integration of different ministries, Department of Housing, etc., SALGO, Department of Energy, but it can be done, and it really should be done. That would make a very big impact. And I think would be an example of what I refer to by saying that it's not just up to Eskom in terms of the incentives. This would be a tariff-based impact. You know, by introducing a tariff, we would get that impact coming through. Okay, the next question had to do with the teachers. I was asked to provide a breakdown of where the teachers are and what we're doing on our Bend the Trainer program. Just to provide more specific information to committee. And bearing in mind, please, Chair, that we've been busy with this program for less than a year, so we will certainly extend it to the rest of the country, but at the moment it is based on the northern part of the country, and in terms of I've mentioned more than 700 learners, I can give you the precise numbers. In Gauteng, that's from Soweto, Ivory Park, to Mbeto, Carter City, and Diepsloot, we have 735 teachers. From Limpopo, 170, and then far smaller numbers from other provinces at the moment, from Northwest, Free State, and Mpumalanga, about 10. So really the program at the moment is based on cutting, but we certainly would expand it, but we first needed to make sure that we've got the correct formula, which we believe we do. In terms of how we've measured the success, I'm reading these statistics of a progress report. So we do, and we certainly do make sure that we track the results of it, and it's once again a progress report that we get on a quarterly basis, and we work together with the relevant schools and educators to make sure that our investment is well spent, and that's in terms of time as well as money. What I can also mention anecdotally here is that we've seen a big impact in terms of two initiatives. Firstly, we have a national schools competition for young scientists, and the standards of those entries have been phenomenal over the last 2 years, and in particular for energy efficiency projects. These can be including, I would extend it to renewable energy such as photovoltaic systems. So clearly there's a big interest stimulated through our project, through our investment in school, in terms of energy efficiency as well as renewable energy. The second is in the quality of the EPA awards. We have for the last 20 years, we've had an energy efficiency award competition, an award ceremony, for energy to award excellence in energy efficiency, and this year's entries have by far exceeded any previous years in terms of quality and number. So we're certainly seeing a groundswell of interest in academic youth and university students coming through on those programs. Chair, in terms of the question about the number of new jobs created, this is of course very important as indicated in my presentation. I could perhaps talk on solar water heating. This is certainly our biggest initiative, and there, conservatively, we've seen that more than 1,000 jobs have been created in the solar water heating industry. Of course, we need more, but at the moment, we'd estimate that to be about 1,000 up, and I would estimate further 1,000 in the balance of our energy efficiency programs from the, once again, from the analysis of our energy services companies that we're busy with. I mentioned during our presentation that there are about 300 active energy services companies who are now participating in our program, so I would say 1,000 new jobs would be conservative. In terms of the marketing expenditure and whether we see a return on investment for that, we certainly do. The Power Alert, if we look at the impact that we measure on our Power Alert program, divide that by the cost, it would be our most cost-effective energy efficiency program. So we would spend in the order of 60 million rand per year for the cost of the Power Alert program, and for an average evening day peak reduction of 200 to 300 megawatts, that ratio certainly is a very good investment. Of course, we do have other marketing campaigns aside from the Power Alert, and that would include the 49M campaign, which you have seen on billboards driving to Parliament this morning, for example. So this comprehensive marketing campaign, and it all is about creating awareness, not only about changing technologies. That has to be both switch to, which is switch to energy efficient technologies, and switch off appliances and equipment, which is not necessary. I'd like to maybe slightly disagree with Michael Sir, which is a very dangerous thing for me to do, because Michael is always right, but I'll do this with some trepidation. But on the issue of whether the solar water heater is working, assuming that it is being correctly installed, yes, that solar water heater would work and would be saving money. Now, I've understood Mike's point to be that a municipal tariff it's got a fixed component and a variable component. So the more you use, the more you pay, and the less you use, the less you pay. And for your variable component, it certainly would be a saving. And Mike, just to clarify, maybe you said, but I don't think you meant that there'd be no saving. You said there'd be no saving. But yeah, smaller than it should be. Okay, I would agree with that. If there's any doubt as to whether solar water heater is actually working or not, we have a department in Eskom specifically looking after solar water heating. We also work together with CESA, who has an ombudsman. So if you feel that your particular solar water heater is not giving you value and your electricity bill hasn't come down significantly, please let us know, and the service that we offer to consumers as well and our customers to look at solar water heaters, and we can certainly assist in individual cases. But the economics of solar water heaters, we believe, including the Eskom rebate, is viable. In terms of the question about the skills development, whether it be local or national, this is a very important point. Once again, I would say that the Wetwall playoffs will be in the solar water heating space. We'll be looking at local communities, for our CFL program as well. We need installation of CFL. We draw installers and project managers from the local communities in which we are operating. And similarly, on the solar water heating side, the installers of the solar water heaters, as well as the ongoing operation on the maintenance side, will be installers will be trained, appointed, and developed, and given basically permanent jobs then for the maintenance within the community. This will be a very much a localized program. The question about rural access by rural communities to our programs. Once again, very important. On our Compact Rest and Lifestyle program, which has been our biggest program, certainly we've been to the rural areas. There is a higher cost associated with going into rural areas because your density of housing is lower. But nevertheless, it has still been a good investment. Where we have encountered complexities is on the solar water heating program. Simply because for a solar water heater to work, you need running water in the home, and that running water must be within certain specifications. It can't contain heavy minerals, etc., and particulates, because it can clog up filters. So this is where we have had difficulty, and many rural homes simply don't have running water in the home, which unfortunately limits the applicability of solar water heating. You referred to Sineri queries, and I'd consulted with colleagues as to what the specific points were that were raised. My understanding is that there were two points raised. The first is that during yesterday's session, first is a question as to whether Eskom is a player and referee on this program. Well, certainly we're a player, and that's what I addressed this morning. In terms of referee, all our programs are measured and independently verified by Eskom's audits and forensics department. Those results are then further, or as part of that, analyzed by independent measurement and verification teams, And then we have external auditors who on an annual basis verify those results again. So we believe that the checks and balances are there. Ultimately, it is our regulator, NERSA, who would express a view as to whether they are satisfied with the independence and the results coming through, and NERSA themselves on an annual basis audit ourselves as well. So there are a number of audits which we are subject to and which our results and our processes are subjected to. So we believe that there's sufficient separation of the player and the referee. Another question which I understand was raised was whether there are penalties if there are underperformance from the Eskom side in terms of that. In other words, do we give money back if we don't achieve the results? I understand that NERSA will be making a presentation. Perhaps they could comment on this. But in terms of the regulatory formula, there are certainly provisions whereby if Eskom didn't perform, we certainly wouldn't keep that money as a profit. I'm pleased to say that, as we've reported before, that we have exceeded our targets, and certainly the intention is to spend all of the allocated funds which have been given to us. As I pointed out, I think this would result in overachieving targets, but the same money, as it were. Question about the regional forums, Chair. We have two types of regional forums within the energy efficiency domain. The first is that we hold forums with energy services companies. That's part of our supply development. And SMEs is on a provincial basis. We do hold workshops with the idea of making sure that we give SMEs the best opportunity possible to participate on our program. Those are held on a regular basis around the country. The second is we do work together with customers, and this is where we have customer forums, and these forums are, we have separate forums for large customers and small customers, but once again, well attended, and the importance of those forums is to once again explain how our programs work and how our customers can participate in those programs. So the second last question deals with the fly ash and the waste energy. We from our power stations, we're aware of technology which involve making very lightweight bricks from fly ash, which would have a tremendous energy efficiency saving, not only electricity, but in terms of the cost of delivering bricks to sites, etc. So, yes, we are in discussion. We in fact provide a lot of ash to the construction industry, and we welcome, of course, any way of using that in an energy efficient way. In terms of the waste energy arising from power stations, yes, we're also looking at ways of putting that waste energy back into the generation cycle. In addition to that, we will be piloting a technology whereby we are using photovoltaic systems to preheat the water going into a boiler. So it really is a focus area for Eskom at the moment. And Chair, I think the last part I'd like to end with a request by yourself to clarify the last statement in the presentation. I'll just read out the statement again. And the statement that I included in the presentation was to say that any significant changes to the current governance and funding of energy efficiency projects would create undue risk to the security of supply in the current constrained electricity system. So what I meant by that was that our planning, and in fact our national plan, including the integrated resource plan, is based on an assumption that the targets which we have in Eskom are achieved. If those targets are not achieved, it puts the plan at risk, and that's what I was referring to. The plan already assumes that those targets would be achieved. And the request was that if there are changes to be made, that we certainly make those changes, but that we cannot afford to stop the program while we make the changes and restart the program in a year or 18 months' time. That does take a while to get a program up and running. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you. I'm sorry. Okay. It's expected that from time to time there are differences of opinion. But noted, it's a pity EIUG have gone, because I just wanted to comment and conclude that obviously the committee take note of EIUG's point, but the assertion that there's no strategy is relative. It doesn't mean that there's no document that exists, but they are just punching holes and making a critique of what is existing. I think what I got that's important to, like, any statement or anything that goes out to the public
it be collectorized in that way. No direction must be given, there is no document, and obviously for the department, surely we are then bound to, you know, look for creative ways of ensuring that the engagement is succeeding. Let me just highlight that, look, this is a journey. Definitely, at some stage, the various players here will come together, whether through the initiative of this committee or even through the initiative of the department, you know. But the ultimate goal that we want, honourable members, is to have a refined, revised, and a better and more powerful energy efficiency strategy. Of course, a lot of things have been raised about the IEP and all of that. Thank you very much to all the three presenters. There's a lot that we still could follow, but we are literally running out of time. Can we then invite Professor Afia from the Center for New Energy Systems from ESIS?
Thank you very much, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members. As you start my talk, apologizing for my accent, because I'm not sure that I'm not a good public speaker. I'm in time. This is my first time in the speaking of Parliament.
So that was the first time, Prof. Never mind.
Also, I take it as my strategy to avoid tough questions. So don't surprise me. Later on, when you ask my questions, I'll pretend I don't know them. Living outside China for almost 20 years, I feel more comfortable to speak Mandarin. I think if today would allow me to speak Mandarin, I feel slightly more comfortable, because at least one honorable member can understand me. Because you can hear that the honorable chair was with me in Mandarin.
Next time, Prof. I'll have to take this to some higher level. Next time.
Thank you very much. I also take the opportunity to compliment all the previous presenters. I think it's very nice and defended part of very, very well. Two key words pop up, technology and implementation. So the university is a typical place where new knowledge is created and transferred, and future leaders of technological implementation are trained. I think that today I would like to tell a little bit of a successful story of National Hub for the Postgraduate Program in Energy Efficiency and Demand Management. I'm sure that I saw in the program that Terry Brettingham from Cincinnati was presenting it. I'm sure that he must have mentioned the name of National Hub and also maybe a bit of the activities. But today I would just to bring a little bit into more details what in the National Hub. The Hub is a 5-year program, actually 6 years. This was the initialization of 2008. So it started from 2008 right through to 2030. It was the initiative by Cincinnati at that time. A couple of months ago it was launched at Cincinnati, and then it was a joint effort by the former DME energist. It was focused on the training of postgraduate students. I said that we are at the peak of the pyramid. So it's hosted by the National, the Center of New Energy Systems at the University of Pretoria. And then there was a very fierce competition among 8 universities. Eventually at the university it was established as a cross-school research unit. So the training program, the formal training program, consists of several levels. In across a few departments, electrical engineering, chemical engineering, mechanical engineering, civil and bioengineering, architecture. And then vertically it's split into honors program, master's program, and PhD program. So you've got different slight variations of master's program. And then it's supposed to be a national hub. It was designed as a national hub and spoke model. Somehow the spoke part didn't happen. Because the funding was constrained. So then the hub part was happening. So within the hub, basically, mostly happens in the University of Pretoria. So we've got several key research groups. For instance, the CNAP, Center of New Energy Systems, and then the group in chemical engineering, a group in
mechanical engineering. So I would like to highlight some of these three groups, because the groups are used in development. In chemical engineering, the group I headed by Professor Tokom Josie, and then they look at continuous and batch processes from chemical engineering. And then they break it into subtopics. I think it's very technical at the moment, but you could see that each of these topics is associated with several masters or PhD students. So each one of them, and then they have also national and international collaborators. A very prolific research group, and won a lot of awards during, which is coincided with the period of the past. This list a few, as an NFTF Category B award, and then the Bill Niemeyer Gold Medal Award for Outstanding Achievement and International Recognition, NRF President Award, A3 British Association Medal, and the Needy Mind Centenary Award of the University of Peterborough. So, Professor Tolga Majorzy. Also, a lot of publications, including the book about the batch chemical process integration. So they do a lot of optimizations about the chemical engineering processes. In a mechanical engineering, there's a heat transfer group headed by Professor Joshua Mayer. So they have quite a large number of full-time teaching members, so actually nine. And then in a university environment, we are talking about NRF rating. So it's got a B rated and a 3Y rated professors. And then two postdocs, 51 full-time postgraduate students, full-time, 15 full-time PhD students. This is already in the engineering department. It's very, very impressive. And then 36 full-time master's engineering students, and then plus part-time students. Also, a lot of achievements, a lot of publications, 85 papers, journals, and then conferences, and then developed experimental platforms, and then do projects for international and national associations and industries, and they are running a lot of industrial projects. The research topics, again, very technical, so the heat transfer, heat exchangers, heat transfer in nanofluids, fuel cells, solar thermal cycles, cooling of our electronics. You see that this is always at the forefront of the new possible technology. As seen as, also we have quite a good representation of the teaching and research staff. We have three formal teaching staff, six research staff, and nine associate members. And we have two members who are NRF rated. So one is A and the other one is B to C. Just this thing, I think it's because in the university environment, sometimes you're competing with each other with the ratings. So across the country, because these ratings are representing the top end scientists in the country. But there are about 60 scientists who are rated A, about 300 less rated B, and then another important category is a P for Presidential Award. So you're talking about 60 members who are rated as young Presidential Awards. Professor Logan Majors is rated as P. So we have B, we have A as well. So we are also currently hosting three postdocs, 12 full-time PhD students. We are also quite good in that sense. Full-time master student 10, and then we have a large number of part-time students. And then I think at the beginning of this year, we are housing the Exara Chair in Energy Efficiency. Exara is partnering with University of Victoria to set up an Energy Efficiency Chair. And also we are quite proliferate. So we publish 52 papers in top journals and conferences. I think we are, I think, as mentioned by Andre, that we are one of the contracted ESCOM contracts MMV measurement and verification teams. And then I can tell, because I thought that I know the answer as well, the power alert when the red flag was flashed. So you're talking about 250 to 300 megawatts, which is really, really very, very impressive. And then we are running about 160 projects. And then we start also one spring off company. I think this is one of the issues that we are also looking at. And then the research topic that seen as we look at almost everything, because we've got a large number of students, industrial energy systems, residential, transport, and then academically new methodologies and energy optimization. And then we have to bring research into energy system performance evaluation. So basically that supports our measurement and verification activities. And then we have also classics in the renewable energy systems and electricity market. So we said that we offer the MMV service for ESCOM, but we also offer service to the Department of Energy funded municipality public lighting funds. So we are doing the measurement and verification at this for two municipalities, Swanee and the City of Cape Town. And then we also, in terms of the MMV, we also provide sort of open source training. So we want to bring MMV to all different levels. So and then we decide to create open platforms so that different levels of people can be trained, which is starting. And then we also help Cinetti in particular to design and implement the tax incentive management system, the trial I systems. So we made a proposal to Cinetti, and then it was funded by the German government. So I thought I consulted with Barry whether I can show some of the snapshots of them. They said not yet. They want to formally launch it by the end of the year. So I won't be able to show it to this audience at the moment. Just to summarize, it was launched in 2008, and the hope we had the Department of Electrical Engineering, CNET, and we have a very strong team, and we have a very spread out research focus. And then we have established a very comprehensive EETSM postgraduate program in electrical, mechanical, chemical, civil, and bioengineering. We develop short courses, and then we develop also the training materials for the public that can be downloaded and then to be learned from that one. So in summary, in terms of publications, so 2011, for instance, we're looking at 60 papers. I want to specifically mention this because we published 60 papers which account to about 50% of all the publications in the country in the sector of energy, so which is the ultimate goal we set about 5 years ago. So altogether, we're looking at 160 papers since 2006. And I think that our proudest achievement is our So when I was compiling this like before, I was also impressed by this figure, so I never looked at this before. We started at Perry Moses at 27 kilos in 2008. In the next year, we increased that to 61, and then to 70, to 90, and then to 109. We increased our student numbers by fourfold, so increased by 300%. And then we do have a contracted target with Cinetti, so we look at the percentage of female and also different population groups. So if we look at the female, we are extremely successful because in engineering background, female students are really a scarce resource. So we started with 4 students, and then now we are looking at 21 students, female engineering students. So this is represents a 4% increase. And the white population, we started with 15, also very strong team initially, and then we ended up with 30. So if you look at the percentage, it will drop of 28%, but if you look at the total number, so we really not that bad. So the black student also is very impressive, starting from 10, and then we are growing that to 48. So we have a 7% increase over the 4-year period, and the Asian students as well. So I must say that we select only the top students. So we call business our reliance on our students. So I want to emphasize that we have the strategic growth without sacrificing our core functionality. So I think that this is one of our proudest achievements. So moving into the future, last year we have already drafted a 7-year strategic plan, because last year we had 2 years in the existing contract, and then we are looking at the next 5-year plan. So it's a 7-year strategic plan that's already in place. It is planned that we want to build a regional research center or institute focused only on energy efficiency. So we're looking at mimic the Lawrence Berkeley National Lab of the U.S. So we provide formal training, technical training, and then we want to provide an open research platform so that different ideas can be debated and challenged. And this becomes the national key lab, and then you can pilot your project. And then we want to, like Lawrence Berkeley Lab, provide strategic advice to different stakeholders. I mean, we want to become a package show ground. There was an initial discussion about branding it jointly with the National University of Pretoria and also investing in the infrastructure of energy efficiency. So it aligns very well with the university's internal energy efficiency strategy. The University of Pretoria has an institutional research theme on energy efficiency, which is going to be formally launched on, I think, next Tuesday. And the University of Pretoria is going to provide the land, and then the land is going to provide part of the initial investment and operational budget. So I think it is going to close into the Cincinnati budget. I don't know whether Gary mentioned that on not yesterday. But then also from the university side, they said they're going to mobilize also their connections with Department of Higher Education and training. I think with this one, I'm sure that I'm going to leave a lot of questions. I leave my contact in here. So if I don't understand your question, you can always talk to a simple email. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Professor. Can we move on to the next presentation? Professor Liu Chna.
Honorable Chair, honorable members, and other people present, thank you very much for this opportunity to throw a spanner in the works, so to call. And but before I start, I have to say a couple of things. I've got to tell you something about my background and why I'm here. But I think I would say that, first of all, I'm an academic engineer. Then I'm a gadgeteer. I'm an energy fanatic and a lighting specialist, probably the only person with a master's and a PhD in lighting in the country. I'm a pragmatist, and my motto is, the bottom line is money. And I remember a quote that I heard somewhere where somebody said, money is not the root of all evil. The lack of money is the root of all evil. Let me start by saying,
where does your passion exactly lie?
I'd like to take a bigger overview of energy efficiency, and I sit back and say I would like to look at the whole big picture. Who are the role players? How do we interact? And where are we going? And where are we going wrong? And I see three groups operating in energy efficiency. I see the green people, which is very plausible and an excellent cause, but I would like to know at what cost. But then we find Eskom, and I'm probably going to put it too blunt, but I think they're in trouble. They haven't got enough power generation, so they haven't got enough power stations, so they've got a lack of power supply, not energy necessarily, but power. So they've got to solve this problem at any cost. And then we have the consumers, and we've heard some mentioning today of individual consumers, and I would like to speak as one of those, not as an academic or a specialist or whatever it is, but more of a consumer. So I find we are addressing a problem, and we're mostly looking at solving the symptoms instead of the illness. And by looking at the consumer, we can answer a couple of the questions of this morning. For example, the uptake of energy-efficient systems by the higher-income market. Why doesn't it happen? Because I think the people say, what am I getting? Do I get value for my money? On the other hand, if you get handouts for free, then you accept it. And you don't ask about whether it's good or bad or whatever it is. I think another point that was discussed but it wasn't clearly explained is on the electricity tariffs. We've got a big two groups once again in this whole energy problem, which is the residential housing sector and the rest. In the housing sector, we do not pay for the maximum demand. We only pay for electricity consumption, and the municipalities decide on what overheads they must include in that price, and they just load it as far as possible to avoid very high energy cost for the consumer. Now, I would like to say that I think it's probably listed in my next slide. I don't have to run through it, but that's more or less quite a number of things, and right in the middle I will get to energy efficient lighting. But for the sake of time, let's state why did I state that thing. What are we looking for? Energy efficiency or not energy efficiency? Are we chasing energy reduction at all costs? And what we're doing is we're ending up by giving electrical energy a bad name. Everybody wants to save electrical energy anywhere as far as possible, and whether it's cost effective is irrelevant. So we have discussed this. Electricity consumption is high. Switch off unused lights, geyser, swimming pool pumps. What is the result of that action? Who's winning out of this action? Eskom is happy because the peak demand drops. I'm not so happy because I've got to switch off my lights, but I can put on my geyser. I will switch it on in any case. If I switch it off now, I'm going to switch it on 10 o'clock at night. So I'm going to use the same amount of energy. So I don't save a cent by switching off anything when the TV ad says switch off. I'm doing it as a sort of token to help Eskom out of debt. Problem. The thought that happened somewhere along the line. But I'm not saving anything. So if we bring in the time of use tariffs, and I think we didn't discuss the possibility of letting the consumer pay for the time of use prepaid instrument, I would be very happy to pay R1,000 for a time of use energy meter, and then I'll switch off my geyser, which incidentally I'm doing, I've put on a time switch. But then I see I get something in return. But Eskom will be happy, the consumer people will be happy, but what about the municipality? They won't be happy. Because if we pay less, their income is less, and where will they get the money if I use my geyser at night, they pay much less for the energy, but they still charge me the R1.50. So that is a very profitable tool that they're using, and when I spoke to City Power about this, they said, no, the extra profit we use for subsidizing other things. But there's a clear motive for municipalities not to go for time of use tariffs, because they're going to lose money out of it. Okay, then there's the one which says switch off and unplug, and that one has luckily disappeared, because what are we saving by unplug your TV set, which is on standby? It's a couple of milliwatts, maybe 100 milliwatts. We're going to extremes nowadays with reducing energy, and we're creating a perception, don't use electricity, it's bad. Why are we so talking when we say energy saving, be it cost effective energy saving or just energy saving or energy effectivity? Why do we always focus on electrical? Why don't we use something like a motor car or something else? I think that, do we realize that when we drive on the freeway and we change our fuel consumption by 1 liter per 100 kilometers, otherwise you slack down by 5 or 10 kilometers an hour and you save 1 liter per 100 kilometers, or you accelerate to 130 and you pay an extra, use 1 extra liter per 100 kilometers. That's equivalent to 5 kilowatts. Now, on one hand, we want to save milliwatts by switching off the TV, but on the other hand, nobody says anything about blowing something like 20 or 30 kilowatts in your car. And that's apart from gases that you have that goes and emit. How do we promote battery vehicles? Charge them from photovoltaic panels. That can be done. At the moment, the battery car is a bad topic because it uses electricity. And Eskom doesn't have electricity. So don't buy battery cars because you're going to overload Eskom again. But we can use photovoltaic panels. Then it's a clean vehicle. It's clean energy. And I will save a lot of money by doing that. Okay, then I've said that. It's interesting, you know, I can use this anecdote. I usually use for the students analogies. There's Coca-Cola. They run out Coke mixture. So now they contact all the consumers and beg them to buy beer. If you can't buy it, I'll give it to you, beer. And then from there on, you will keep on drinking beer instead of Coke.
This is the feeling I get from our electricity utilities, that as long as you don't buy our product, we'll be happy. We'll give you a gas tip, but just stop using our product. So what happens? Turnover drops, profit drops, downscaling, the whole sector will have to downscale, increased electricity price, more government subsidies required, and we all pay higher taxes. I also put there something, watch it, you're very provocative and going to get into very deep trouble. At my age, you see, I'm not that concerned. I believe we should go and always use the slogan which says sustainable or cost-effective energy saving. And that is why the higher income households don't necessarily buy LEDs or solar geysers, because they can't prove that they can save money within a reasonable span of time. The payback period, if it's more than 5 months, they don't want to do it. Unless somebody gives them lamps or geysers for free, then they will use it. But I'm not too sure that I'll put in a solar geyser even if I get it for free. If you've been to Greece, you will know what solar geysers look like. Okay, most energy-saving systems are expensive. We can do many fantastic energy-saving systems, but they are expensive. So what do? We have to convince the consumer that he or she will save money immediately, or if not, you make a capital investment to buy that thing. You haven't got the money now, so, but still you have to do it. But eventually, after 5 months or a year, you'll get your money back. Now try and convince that. Convince a person who's got insufficient income to buy on a payback period type of thing. So this is hard to believe. We have to provide subsidies, and then it will probably work. We have to hand out free geyser blankets, CFLs, LED lamps, etc. Now, number two and three are very expensive in the motivational tools, and who pays for these tools of motivating the consumers to become more energy saving? And then what happens when handouts or subsidized equipment fail? If I got three lamps in my house and get three LEDs for free and the third one goes the next morning, which it can, the worst thing anybody can say is to say that LEDs last 50,000 hours. That's a lie. It's definitely not true. So the LED goes tomorrow morning, what does the guy do? Goes back and buy a 60-watt incandescent bulb. So where does Eskom's calculations go? And that's a problem with many of these energy-saving things. Do we know where they've actually saved energy and how much? Once again, if you split the two sectors, the residential and the others, these guys have got maximum demand, they've got energy meters, they've got demand meters, they know. But in the residential sector, you have no idea of how much energy you save. You do estimations, or guesstimations, I would rather call them. But I can use an example, and I've done the complete simulation. Those are the things we like to do at universities, that if you put in an LED, and whether you pay for it, the cost is not that important. But if that lamp doesn't burn for at least 3 hours every day, your payback period is infinity. You never get your money back. So when you go for a commercial installation, you probably have 24 hours. Street lighting, 12 hours. Solid state lighting will work there. But in your house, I've got LEDs, but only if I know which ones are going to burn for at least 3 hours a day. Another thing is LEDs improve so fast that within the next 4 years, we're going to replace all existing LEDs with LEDs of 200 lumens per watt or better. Okay, should we invest in electrical energy, power reduction, or in renewable energy? And I think there was quite sufficient discussion on that. I think it is we're treating the symptoms, we're not treating the illness. And we should really consider and do exposed factor calculations of, is it worth our while to have all these massive infrastructures to monitor and check and do all this verification? For that money, we probably could have bought a nuclear power station from China or something. But at least then you've got permanent supply. Energy-saving gadgets are temporarily and may actually go reverse cycle as well. We should promote electrical use versus other forms of energy like coal, gasoline, etc. We should say, buy an electric vehicle. It's much cleaner energy than gasoline. Once we establish high capacity of renewable power stations, we are going to encourage people to use more electricity to reduce the per unit cost. Once we invest in renewable, we want the people to use as much as we possibly can supply. Charging batteries for electric vehicles, cars, buses. Electrical vehicle is not only a car. You can really look at buses, trucks, and many others. Extra power generation is guaranteed to work. Most energy-saving technologies are not guaranteed to be successful. Then I'll quickly touch on the topic of energy-efficient lighting. Lighting, 20% of all energy, electrical energy use goes into lighting. The bad thing about lighting is not like a motor or a pump which says it's just technical, it works. Lighting is effective, but also pleasing. A lighting installation should be pleasing. So once I get this free CFL or whatever, I stick it in and my wife says, what did you do now? Then it goes up again. So lighting is much more than just calculating energy. And I can almost tell you now that I don't know of a single LED downlighter that matches an incandescent lamp for quality and quantity of light distribution. So you have to maintain, once you go for a new technology in lighting, the lighting should be much better. It shouldn't be the same or worse. It should be much better. The new technology should be, wow, this is fantastic. What is it? Okay, this is LED. And I'm worried about whether we're actually in that direction. Has it got real? Is it cost effective without reducing the quantity and the quality of light? Very seldom. If it was, why don't more consumers buy such lamps, solar geysers, or whatever, without being disappointed with their new installations? They do it to reduce their electricity bill. That's the only reason they put in LEDs or CFLs, to pay less for electricity. And then they start saying, well, what's the payback period on this thing? Has it got great potential, solid-state lighting, LEDs? Yes, LEDs are the light source of the future with great commercial potential for retrofit and smart lighting, which is the next phase we're moving in. LEDs will within 2 years, reach 200 lumens per watt. Now, just to explain that, a condensed lamp gives you about 8 to 10 lumens per watt. A CFL gives you about 40 lumens per watt. A linear fluorescent, maybe 70 lumens per watt. LED is probably around 80 lumens per watt. But the LED is on an exponential growing curve, and we're getting to 200 lumens per watt. So there it will replace all other lamps. Success example of stimulating manufacturing and marketing of LED retrofit lamps. I have to mention this. The United States is not one of my favorite countries, but they do some things right. So they've got the Department of Energy, the L Prize, Lighting Prize competition. This time it's the second round. They do a Part 58, these floodlight lamps. They want to do an LED. And what they did was to say, okay, the first prize is $5 million. Here are the minimum specifications. 123 lumens per watt, 11 watts, and 1,350 lumens. Not a closing date. The first guy that gets there gets $5 million. Provided it's made in America, by Americans, and sold in America. Once you win that competition, you get signed a contract with all government departments and most commercial companies that will buy that land from you. It's a big challenge. 123 lumens per watt is a challenge. But you can see the approach of the Americans. It's getting more local. Stimulate the economy, stimulate manufacturing, doing job creation, etc. That's a tremendous. We're probably going to indirectly enter that competition. Okay, then I want to say something about the photovoltaic power energy. We can learn from Germany. They haven't got a lot of sunlight, but they've got a fantastic PV program running there. They're going to scale it down. But PV, personally, I think is the way to go. The clean energy, we can now go below 50 volts a watt for a PV panel. We've got very high solar irradiance. It's simple to install diverse applications. You've not got only solar energy moved into heat to create hot water. You can use it. You can extend every year with another panel. We've got good battery technology. It can be manufactured locally.
consumers can sell back energy. Like, I believe in Cape Town, you can actually do that. So if you've got photovoltaic panels on your roof, you go away for a month or whatever, you sell electricity back to the city council. Photovoltaic geysers, this is just one of our research topics. University is about teaching and research. We've got doing research on simple installation of PV panels into your existing geyser. No inverter, just switching a double dual element in the geyser, and your panel can be anywhere, and you can feed two or three geysers, no plumbing. It's just a piece of cab tire or flex to the individual geysers, and we switch the elements in series and parallel. Everybody will tell you it's not efficient, but we've proven it to be. You aim it at the winter angle, because in winter you want more energy. Surplus energy can be sold to utility, charge your UPS, heat your swimming pool, etc. Most energy required in winter. Okay, in the electric vehicle, I have to touch on this because they're available now in the country. Electric cars are available, but as I said, vehicles, we can't really compete with other manufacturers. Technology for now and the future, the electric vehicle, energy saving, energy store, no pollution, reliable, simple to use and maintain. In your electric vehicle, you immediately have a backup power supply of about 40 kilowatt hours, whatever it is. So it's an energy store, it's a vehicle and no pollution, and we need electricity to charge it. It supports energy saving. And now my question is, does energy reduction at all costs sink the battery car in South Africa? Possibly. Conclusion, cost-effective energy efficiency without reducing quality of whatever you replace. We have to do research, design, develop, introduce, maintain, and quantify and evaluate. I remember my old professor who said, if you can't measure what you do, then you probably don't know what you're doing. What we find at the university in lighting laboratories is if you don't measure, you don't really know what to measure. Only when you start measuring do you actually find out what there is to measure. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Honorable Members. Honorable Fraley.
Thank you, Chair. Thanks for the presentations. But I'm not taking issue with the last presentation, but as you said, you are up for it. The issue around time of use tariffs. Now, you said that it's not in the municipality's interest to introduce time of use tariffs. I mean, I completely disagree. And the reason why I completely disagree is that at the moment, Cape Town, for instance, and I always use them as an example because I've worked with them, they have about 26 different tariffs that they have to pay to Eskom. Now, in a peak period, okay, between 6 to 8, I think, on a Wednesday evening, they have to pay about 280 a kilowatt hour for the energy they buy from Eskom. Yet they're charging a flat rate to households at the moment of about 150 a kilowatt hour. They are clearly losing out at the moment during that peak period. It's the cost to the municipality over that period. If they can have a time of use tariff and a time of use heater is able to do that, then clearly they can charge a higher rate during that period that is more commensurate with what they're having to pay Eskom for. But clearly it's in the municipality's interest to have a differentiated tariff. Otherwise they've got to smooth it out over the entire period. And it's also in the interest of households to be able to then adjust their behavior so that they can actually pay a lower household energy usage if they do that. So it is in everyone's best interest to have a better time of use tariff. And that is clearly where we have to move towards. So it has to be in municipalities. The big problem, though, is the cost of installing the time of use meters is something which is prohibitive for municipality to roll out, and that's why we probably need to do it on a national level. So I would certainly take issue with you on that. And then in terms of LED lights, I mean, I also have to take issue with you on that particular one as well. I mean, I've installed LED lights in my house, and I've been going now for 3 years, and it's been fantastic. I haven't had to replace the light bulb, which is a huge difference also just from a kind of menial thing of not having to replace light bulbs. But I mean, if I look at it, I'm saving, if I go from a 60-watt bulb to a 6-watt bulb, which is what I did do, I'm making a saving there of around about $3.60 a month. So I can pay those off within about a year and a half to 2 years. I'm paying that off. And then it's essentially free in terms of that. Okay, because I bought that light bulb for about 100 grand. So, clearly we are, clearly, this doesn't kind of bear out. I mean, the real problem to me around energy efficiency and the reason why people don't do it, and I think you alluded to it, is the high capital cost at the start. To me, it's not an economic problem. It's a financial problem. It's a problem of people not being able to afford a high capital cost. And not seeing the savings that come from that. I think it's also a bit of a cognitive dissonance problem. If people don't always recognize the benefits of this. So people would rather spend 10,000 Rand putting a flat screen TV into their house because they get an immediate benefit from this. If they spend 10,000 Rand putting a solar water heater in, they still get hot water. What's the benefit for them? They don't see that initially. So savings is something which kind of is relegated to another part of our brain as opposed to immediate gratification from flat screen TV. So, those are the things that we have to really confront. And these are the reasons why people aren't moving toward energy efficiency. And that's why government policy has to address those in terms of behavioral changes. And that's what we need to do in the committee and this government. Thank you.
Can I just respond to that?
No. Any other input?
Thank you, sir. I just want to clear out of my confusion. As far as either, is it cost-effective to switch it off in the morning, switch it on in the evening? Is it something that benefits whoever? Another question for me, it goes back to do with data. This is Giza. Okay. In Kingdom Come, I'm based. For the last 3 or 4 months or so, well, older than cold, I had to switch my electric Giza on 2 hours because I couldn't get hot water for. So that confuses me. Is this where the general light put in for this?
outsource their expertise elsewhere. I know if you were dealing with your peers, maybe you could have been more elaborate and in detail. But if you appreciate what I've raised here, is that we want information, ideas, observations, analysis from the public, including people like you, in order to help us to mold a set of recommendations that will influence the executive work on energy efficiency, even how it works with the public at the end of the day. And it is on that basis that I would humbly appeal that you tweak your input, you know, that the, all the sections that dealt with, you know, you help us by at least ensuring that there is a certain body of facts, you know, some substance that will make us think that this is the basis on which you know, Professor Roshna is saying there are turnover drops, profit drops, because as you could see, you know, instinctively, Honorable Kharini reacted, you know, I don't want to repeat to this, because ever since I started, you know, also switching off my geyser for the whole day and switching it on, I saw a drop in my bill. Whether it's for the benefit of ESCOM, at the end of the day, ESCOM is a state-owned entity, not a private company. Just look at the bottom line. You know, ESCOM accounts to this committee as well as the Portfolio Committee for Public Enterprise, as well as the Committee for Economic Development in the National Council of Provinces, all because we want to see ESCOM making an impact. And we've allowed various aspects to bombard ESCOM with criticisms, with questions, with everything, so that ESCOM can improve, you know, in its work. And Mr. Edwinder said today, you know, that ESCOM's culture is very clear. It's not about the bottom line, the profit margin. It's about ensuring that the sustainable supply of electricity, in conjunction with the electricity supply at municipal level, and in future with IPPs as well. So it would be helpful then we get the facts as to how you see things differently. Remember, in order to get the best outcome, the best ideas, it's good to see, for people to see differently, a dialectical approach in things. I would like also to respond to this one. You say, if you say do not choose and unplug, that is not helpful. But to me, even if unplugging would have milliwatts saved, the fundamental benefit, amongst others, is that it builds and enhances the culture of efficient use of resources. Because at the end of the day, we may be talking about energy efficiency now, but as citizens, as residents of South Africa, as people in various you know, aspects of the South African society, we have to play our role on efficient use of resources, amongst others. So even if it was milliwatts, that's fine. Because it will make me change my social and economic behavior so that I save water, I reuse, I recycle. You know, all of those things. You can start just with this electricity. Some could be water. And by changing social behavior on how you efficiently use water, you will think the same when it comes to electricity, vice versa. Sort of, what's your take on that? Over to you.
Honorable Chairman, yes. Okay. I have to apologize first. The time we did that simulation, the municipality energy tariff per kilowatt hour from ESCOM was less than the household energy tariff per kilowatt hour. Only the energy tariff from ESCOM to 20 was less than the consumer. So at that time, it was benefiting the municipalities, and Swanee, City of Swanee acknowledged the extra profit that they make when they shift the consumers to later at night. But I apologize because I haven't used new numbers, and I will most definitely redo those simulations. On the LED life, unfortunately, there's a lot of this information going around, and we're working very close with the Rensselaer Polytech Lighting Research Center, which says if life expectancy is specified for an LED, you must state whether it's the LED chip, the LED lamp, or the LED luminaire. The LED chip gives the light output goes down to 70% at rated light, which can be 50,000 or 60,000 hours. But the LED lamp consists of a lot of electronics, and your electrolytic capacitor doesn't get that life unless you buy an extremely expensive one. So manufacturers very seldom specify the lamp, life expectancy of the LED lamp. Then it depends in what luminaire do you put. They're all designed for convective cooling, which means air must flow over them. The moment you put the downlighter in a luminaire where there is no airflow, the whole thing goes bonkers. And then you must also remember that life expectancy for any lamp says at rated life, 50% of the lamps, not more than 50% of the lamps have failed. That means your LED lamp can go tomorrow or the day after, but at the rated life, 50% will be gone. Now, many architects plaster these LED lamps into the lamp because they think they're going to last 50,000 hours, but there's no way. You can speak to a number of, I've got good links with many architects that the ones specifically do gas stations, and 40% of the LED lamps failed within the first 6 months. So one must be careful, and that's why I say, if you've got a 24-hour application, then your payback period for your LED installation is about 7 months. If it goes below 3 hours every night, you go to about 20 or 30 years. And if the luminous efficacy goes up to 200 lumens per watt within 3 years, by that time we're going to replace all current LEDs with other ones that use half the energy and probably cost one-third of the price. So all I'm saying is one must be careful when you think this is the ultimate solution, and the LED technology is still fairly young. Not the chip, but the lamp and the drivers and the luminaires. Those things must be improved. Okay. Then on the geyser time switch, most definitely, well, if you live in a perfect physics world and the geyser's got infinite insulation, then it doesn't matter when you switch it on. You put in so many kilojoules to heat the water and there it stays. But geysers are not perfect, so they lose heat. So if you use a timer, time switch, and make sure that you expect to go and bath at 7 o'clock, you switch the geyser on at 5 o'clock. And you do the same in the morning, or probably not even in the morning, then you're definitely going to save energy. And I've got two geysers, I've got time switches on both, and my electricity for the geysers between 300 and 400 rand a month. And that's why I'm saying, also, a nuisance factor is very difficult to put into monetary terms. I've done put in a solar geyser, and I'm going to save 100 of the 400 rand or something. But I've got to pay for this thing, I've got to do the maintenance, I've got to replace this thing in 10 or 20 years. I'm not too sure that it is cost-effective unless government puts in a big subsidy or ESCOM subsidizes the solar geyser. But on its own, I should fully agree with what Mike said. I can't prove on paper that for the standard household, the nuisance factor, all those things brought into the system, it's worth it. But time switching definitely works. And I'm doing it because I want to help ESCOM solve their problem, but I'm not saving any money. Then there was the analogy, which unfortunately I do apologize, Mr. Chairman. I was looking back and thinking of a general company in the world, not ESCOM. It was specifically not aimed at ESCOM, but it says if a company's turnover drops, then you've got to do something to balance your statements. And I definitely left out case studies or whatever it is, but I think if you reduce your sales, you have to reduce your costs, and that brings down all the factors that I've listed, but it's definitely not a case study, and it's not aimed at ESCOM or anything, but this is when a consumer sits back and he reads the Time magazine or whatever it is, and he said, hang on, we want to reduce electricity, and this is an electricity utility, which is contradicting to all the utilities in the United States, for example. The 3-watt thing,
I do agree. It's once again cost-effective energy saving. It's not just let's save energy. If you're going to switch your TV and unplug it every day, by the end of the year you're going to either replace the plug or the TV. So I'm not sure whether it's cost-effective to save a couple of milliwatts while we all drive 130 kilometers on the freeway and we waste 10 or 20 kilowatts. So maybe the point was more to let's move away from only electricity, minute quantities, and come with a blank statement which says, and I fully agree with what you're saying, but let's reduce, let's ignore why and when. That's when the upper echelon at group 3 income people says, I'm paying for the electricity. I would like to use, I would like to switch all the light in my house. And whatever Eskom charged me, I will pay for it. Now it comes to the point where Eskom says, but Anna, my coal-fired power station is not green. And that's why I'm trying to make the future dream, the future technology. When we buy photovoltaic panels, which is locally made, that less energy than what the panel can produce, then we're going to encourage people to use more electricity. Because then your photovoltaic plant can make a profit. So I'm concerned that we over-exercise the reduction of electrical energy at all costs and ignore all other energy sources. I must also take issue, or I would like to state an example which I personally experienced with the new Bureau Standard 204 on energy efficiency. I'm in the process of building a house in Tony, and the building regulation says, thou shall use double glazing, thou shall use heat pump, thou shall use this and this. Maybe I can afford it, but the low-income people cannot afford that. If I simply said to them, but hang on, I'm putting up photovoltaic panels, I can use any heat pump or any geyser. You cannot make recommendations, laws. And I'm concerned that we're moving into a very expensive energy-saving milieu, like we call it in Afrikaans. It's the thing that we make you pay for double glazing and for everything for the sake of saving energy. And I rest my case.
I don't know if there was another
Thank you very much for resting your case. But can I remind you, if you look at the advert that went out in the papers, it was very clear that it welcomed him to how we go forward, not so honorable members. And can I indulge on you, Prof, once again, to the extent that even your heading here is a little bit scary because it says reduce at all costs. Why? That's not what you wanted here. We wanted citizens of South Africa from all walks of life, academics, experts, activists, civil society, whoever, to come and tell this parliament, because we are acting here as these members on behalf of this parliament, to say, here is the status quo. This is what how can you remedy? What are the solutions? So my appeal is once again, if you could go back to your presentation, work it out, because we got points, I want to repeat, it's important that we listen to all views, but obviously views must come with facts, because the fact will help us. It's the basis on which you can turn and go to the delegates and say, look, various inputs during the public hearing were presented in this manner, and this is what we take into account, but as it is, rather unfortunately, it's not helpful. And I can see the eyes from Eskom are looking at me very sharply to make sure that I am giving a balanced response to everything. And you appreciate even other inputs were helpful. And when the IUG came strongly around the issue of the energy efficiency strategy, I'm pretty bound to say, bring back to say there's no strategy. And they made it very clear that they are aware strategy is there, but they are putting holes in it. They are highly critical of it, which is a different point, altogether. And in that respect, I expect, obviously, down the line, as we move and come up with a better energy efficiency strategy, the department will respond, they will engage in AIG. So also on the same token,
from your side, you know, for others to respond to your assessments, it will be helpful to panels get your input and help us in that. Not only ECOM, but whoever else. In that respect, Sean Dange, can we come back at quarter past two? Let's break for lunch now and be back at quarter past two. Good.